Sunday night, The Riff is your home of the best local music in Detroit. And now, every Thursday night, US 12 on Michigan Avenue in Wayne is the home of the Motor City's best live local music. Ladies, you always get in free at US 12. Plus, US 12 is the place to go see live local rock talent every Thursday night in Metro Detroit. Want to see the best up-and-coming talent in the Motor City? US 12 in Wayne is the club that breaks all the bands. Come on by US 12 this Thursday and check it out for yourself.
Hey, this is Jay Hudson from Motor City Riffs. Come by US 12 in Wayne this Thursday night for live local rock from some of the Motor City's finest.
This Thursday, catch Zug Island, Clear, and Mind Candy.
Don't forget, CDs and merchandise are available at the show.
And if you're interested in getting in on the bill, check out US 12's ad and Real Detroit Weekly. Make sure you come out to US 12 in Wayne every Thursday night to hear Detroit's best local music. US 12 is right on Michigan Avenue at 2nd Street, just east of Wayne Road. US 12, the club that supports local music. Attention local musicians, McGregor's needs your help. McGregor's prides itself on being the place downriver to see the best live music Metro Detroit has to offer. To continue to be the best, this is where you come in. McGregor's would like to invite you to drop off or mail your demo to them so they can continue to showcase the best live music in the area. If you're looking for a new spot to play and want to work with a place that'll treat you right, then McGregor's is the place for you. Just stop by or mail your demo. It's that simple. Have a night off and want somewhere cool to hang? Every Tuesday is Power Hour and a Half. All bottled beer and mixed drinks are just $1.50 for an hour and a half. McGregor's has great food and a fun atmosphere. Come in and enjoy a variety of great menu choices, including 24-ounce steaks and crab legs, as well as soups, salads, and tons of other choices. McGregor's at Telegraph Row near West Road in Brownstown Township. Call for more info at 734-675-3870. Help McGregor's to continue to feature the best live music downriver. Get your demo to McGregor's.
Hi, I'm David Hall from Rock Financial. And I know it's late, but rockfinancial.com is the perfect late-night option for folks looking at mortgage options. How about interest-only options, even for first-time homebuyers? Well, you can find them at rockfinancial.com. Maybe you have questions about down payments, private mortgage insurance, closing costs. Our website can help you get the answers that you need at rockfinancial.com. And the mortgage experts at Rock Financial, well, they provide expert advice for first-time homebuyers, folks ready to refinance. Maybe you're looking to step up to your second or third home. rockfinancial.com is a great resource. You can get into a new home for little or no money down. If you go to rockfinancial.com and check out your options, you'll know a lot more. Most monthly payments for first-time homebuyers are less than rent payments. So if you go to rockfinancial.com, explore all your options, you'll find out. It's late night. It's perfect time to go to rockfinancial.com.
Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company and equal housing lender.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much and welcome, everybody. Pleasure to be back. Man, we didn't do this last week. And usually,
wait a minute, I'm pushing the wrong thing here. There we go. Usually, I never find out that I'm having the holiday weekend off until after I've done the week before show. So people call, what happened, man? Where's the show? You know, they cut you off. And no way. So anyways, we're back. 2 weeks worth of stuff to talk about. And I just wrote a note to myself, review production for Night Call. Production is the stuff, the recorded stuff. And that's the way this begins. It says you're listening to Night Call. So that makes it sound like it's already in progress. Anyways, that's just technical stuff. I'll give you a few more technical things and then take your calls at 313-298-WRIF. Big subjects, I guess, Amnesty International, the United States, always citing their indictments of other countries, the kind of abuses that go on all across the world. Amnesty International always there to criticize those countries because they don't owe any allegiance to any country whatsoever. What they owe allegiance to are human rights. And suddenly, the United States comes under the microscope, and Bush and Cheney and all these other guys are all upset, so we'll talk about that as well. Rumsfeld, Secretary of War, critical of China's armaments, wondering why are they building up their armaments. We'll talk about that. And also Watergate. What is this now? Like 30 years later, finally we find out who Deep Throat is. And Some people think that he ought to be getting the FBI director that that blew the whistle on Nixon, sent him packing. A wonderful sight, either if you know it through history or lived through it. You get rid of another one of these criminal Republicans. They have such a... Oh, they're always involved in criminal activity, violating some law, aren't they? They're sort of into this triumph of the will deal. They're kind of like Ubermensches. They're not bound by law or convention or morality. They're just the strong man, right? Oh yeah, that's right. We have a democracy, don't we? Oh well, you know, you can't always pay attention to that stuff. Well, pardon me. There is so much pollen in the air. I mean, I don't have allergies or anything like this. By the way, if you're ringing now, hold on. Jay Hudson, who is our producer, also the fine producer of Motor City Riffs, which precedes this show, will grab your call. 313-298-WRIF for the shy or those that don't want to spend the dime to call the show. I know some of you are listening all around the country and all around the world. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. Call talkyes@yahoo.com, and keep it short, and then I may read it. If you want to write something long, I'm probably going to have to deal with it tomorrow morning. Anyways, a beautiful, warm day. Now, I'm saying that slowly because, I don't know, as I get older, the real hot weather doesn't do much for me. Oh, pollen in the air, right. So it's not even a matter of having an allergy to this stuff, but rather it's just floating around. It's like you're coating my throat. You can go to my house, and you can run your fingers down my car, and it's like, I don't know, an eighth inch, maybe not that deep, but you know, like there's a layer of fine yellow dust, and half of that, excuse me, is in my throat. Anyways, that, I suppose, just makes it a little deeper, right? Okay. So anyway, it's warm, and my wife and I usually take these long walks around the neighborhood with the pooch. Now, some of you have caught on after all these years that I never mention my wife's name, nor do I mention the pooch's name. And why is that? Because I'm forbidden to do so. And obviously not by the pooch. So, we'll just let it go at that. So anyways, wife stays home, Peter grabs pooch, and we charge out into the 90-degree heat, and we go over to the 9 Mile Road area of Ferndale. In fact, up and down 9 Mile Road, just west of Woodward, where the Gay Pride Festival is going on. And this really makes me feel good. I mean, it says that we live in a community where people that are gay, that have throughout history been dealt the worst kind of everything from, you know, death to scorn. Scorn's bad enough, but of course we know that that oftentimes that violence and death has been directed at homosexuals, at lesbians, people that don't fit into the so-called common mold. And so to see people out there with this sense of pride is really, I don't know, just gives me a good feeling about where I live, gives me a good feeling that I live in a community where people feel that they can express themselves in the way that they choose, not in the way that other people think they should live or act or do whatever in private. That they can exercise their own sense of their lives, whatever's directed internally. And some of it, I mean, as you could walk around this area, I would say 85%, 90% maybe of the people that appeared to me to be gay, I mean, sometimes because they were guys walking hand in hand or women walking hand in hand, or I don't know, I suppose if I was with another guy and I had a pooch, and actually I had an AIDS Walk t-shirt on, they'd probably assume that I was gay as well. So I don't know. You can't tell the players without a scorecard, and who the hell wants to keep a score except for a bunch of wackos who are concerned about other people's business and not theirs. Because you got to remember this. I mean, this is one of the lessons that I took from this Tai Chi training that I take from it. If you're paying too much attention to other people, and particularly other people's business, you're not taking care of your business enough. If you're looking at other people and judging them, you're not internally taking into account who you are and what you're doing. In fact, very frequently it is a way of diverting attention from dealing with your own problems, and you start seeing problems in other people.
there's something wrong with them, the color of their skin or their sexual choice or their gender or who knows, you know, their religion or something. The troublemakers, the toxic minority in every society always tries to make trouble on the basis of difference. Most people that are healthy emotionally, they don't care. We don't care. We don't care what other people do as long as they're not harming other people. They can even harm themselves. You know, like, I don't care. Well, I do care if people smoke. But, I mean, well, you know, in terms of smoking inside of places, if your little victim is suicide, yes, murder, no. So, but, I mean, if people want to go outside and smoke, I guess they know the risks, and that's okay. Right? And the same thing, sort of a libertarian view about drugs as well. If people have the information of the results of abusing drugs, there's no the political state has no business stepping in and making those people criminals. All right. So there's a gay pride festival. Me and the Pooch walked through it. Some good music is being played. A lot of it's interesting that that businesses know what a large community gays are because they were there in force. Small businesses and big businesses, right? So anyway, this is making a short story kind of long. But in the meantime, if you have any comments on this, 313-298-WRIF or anything else that pops into your head or some of the things I introduced. So I'm thinking that I have a pride, too, that I'm proud to live in a diverse community. I'm proud to live in a community that allows people to express themselves in terms of how they define themselves. Oh, I said most people you couldn't tell. Some people, some guys were really into very, very flamboyant and flaming costumes. And good, good. I mean, who wants to see a bunch of people just walking around in brown suits all the time? And what do I care? And you know, people say, well, as long as they don't flaunt it. Flaunt it. Flaunt it, isn't that it? Flaunt it, yeah. I mean, what do you care if they flaunt it? It. It. Anyway, then I look at this news here, and what does it say? Lansing. That's our capital here in Michigan, if anyone's listening around the world. We're broadcasting from Detroit. Doctors or other health care providers could not be disciplined or sued if they refused to treat gay patients under legislation passed Wednesday by the Michigan House. This is a few weeks old. The bill allows health care workers to refuse service to anyone on moral, ethical, or religious grounds. The Republican, what a surprise, right? The Republican-dominated House passed the measure as dozens of Catholics looked on from the gallery. The Michigan Catholic Conference, which pushed for the bills, hosted a legislative day for Catholics on Wednesday at the state capitol. The bills now go to the Senate, which is also controlled by the Republicans. But fortunately, it will not be signed because the governor is a Democrat, Governor Jennifer Granholm. But what a repulsive insult. I mean, these people ought to get some other work. These are people, for instance, they could say that they would, I don't know who else, moral, ethical, or religious grounds. So it's mostly against gays. It's called the Conscientious Objector Policy Act, which would allow health care providers to assert their objection within 24 hours when they receive a notice of a patient or procedure which they don't agree. So rather than... I don't know. This is really bad. I say, well, yeah, I can imagine. Who cares about gay people? Yeah. How about this? These pharmacies now are not, they will not fill prescriptions for morning after pills or for contraceptives or anything to do with birth control. All right? That affects then everybody. So you have these people, talk about playing God. And these arrogant people who think they're acting out God's will, right? Some pharmacists across the country are refusing to fill prescriptions for birth control and morning after pills, saying that dispensing the medications violates their personal, moral, or religious beliefs. Well, why don't you get out of the profession? How about that? That'll solve it all. And see what aggravation these toxic people are? This is what I mean. You know, they can grumble. Well, they shouldn't be using, what do you call those things? Condoms. They shouldn't use condoms, right? So I'm not going to fill it or sell it to them. Or if they have birth control pills, and sometimes birth control pills, some of you women may want to call in and remind me, there's other stuff that birth control pills are used for. Isn't that, what is that called? There's some thing having to do with stuff forming on the uterus. Aren't I correct on this? I don't know. 313-298-WRIF or calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
So, here we go. Again, these people are always at the center of problems. They're always talking about how moral they are, how ethical they are, how religious they are, how born again they are. There's always something, right? But what they're really doing is making trouble. They are a constant burr in our saddle, rather than, they never solve problems, they only create problems. You think that's true? 313-298-WRIF and calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I mean, here's the deal. Here's the way it should work. If they don't want to use birth control, don't use birth control. If they don't want to use morning after pills, don't use morning after pills. And in terms of medical procedures and stuff like that, hey, isn't there something called the Hippocratic Oath? Where as a health practitioner, you have an oath to help people in terms of whatever is legal? I mean, who the hell gave these people the right to decide what is moral and ethical? You go to my website, peterwerbe.com, PETERWERBE.com. I was just handed a note. It says those birth control pills can be used to regulate monthly periods for women. All right. So, but some self-righteous druggist is going to say, no, I'm not going to do it, because every time you do it, you are supposed to reproduce, or you can play, well, let's get people mad if I'll say that. What's another word for it? Birth control roulette. You know, what is this thing called? The rhythm method. I mean, it's ridiculous. Do you realize that if every time people had sex, they had a kid? I mean, we got too many people in the world to begin with. Anyways, PETERWERBE.com. This is being broadcast, by the way, on radiopower.org as well as WRIF.com. And radiopower.org will repeat this show at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. The whole thing will then be archived at whiterosesociety.org. And one more little piece of business here, and maybe we'll get to your calls. So people may be, you know, I always ask, by the way, I always ask our producer and phone screener, Jay Hudson, don't put up on the screen what people want to talk about. So I have no idea. I mean, nobody else that I know of ever does this. But see, if I'm talking like to somebody and I get distracted. You know, because I'm talking about one thing and someone says, I want to talk about Social Security, and the person thinks your figures are all wrong. So I start, so anyway, so I don't know what's going on. I want to thank you to the people from Democratic Media. Actually, it's Good Writers, isn't it? They present the Democratic Media Award for 2005, and they awarded it to my show, this show, Night Call. And this is, I think, the third year in a row. So thank you very much, folks. You can go to my website and click on the little emblem there. Kind of, I think, what is it? A sunflower? Something like that. And anyway, it says Democratic Media Award 2005, and you can see their whole list of independent media resources. I think it's just at goodwriters.net if you don't want to bother with mine as well. Okay, let's see. What else? All right, let's just see where people are going, and then we can talk about some other subjects as well. Hi, this is WRIF. You are on the air. Good evening. Let me see here. Did I do this correctly? Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air.
Hello, this is Mike Gibson calling. Hello.
Hey, Mike. You got to let me finish your sentences, then I'll speak too. Go ahead.
All right. Hello, this is Mike Gibson calling from Birmingham.
You know, here's the problem, Mike. Turn your radio completely off.
All right, thanks.
Okay, that is the problem. Hold on one second, Mike. We, as of next week, callers, we will have solved the problem of why you can't hear it on the air. We're also on an 8-second delay, so I see why he got confused. So you can listen on the radio, but as soon as you hear my voice on the telephone, turn off your radio. All right, Mike, go ahead. Is this Mike from Birmingham?
This is Mike Gibson from Birmingham. I've called in a few times before. I want to talk about the. Did you ever hear the straight edge kids?
I have. Tell people what those kids are.
Well, it's years ago, back in the 80s, there's a movement of punk rockers, and they call themselves the straight edge kids. And what it was they wanted to break away from like the excesses and the indulgences of rock and roll at the time where people were using drugs and smoking and drinking. So they decided, well, we're not going to smoke, we're not going to drink, we're not going to use drugs, we're going to be vegetarians.
Then we're not going to have sex either.
We're not going to have sex.
Right.
Either. And but it got to such an extreme that they started hanging out in gangs and like they would put X's on their right hands to signify the allegiance to the straight edge gangs. And they'd go around beating up people that saw smoking a cigarette, they'd go to a party and if someone was drinking a beer, they'd beat the crap out of that person. But now it's gotten to the point where they're against like the eating of animals and flesh.
Uh-huh.
And so. Supposedly, I heard that a bunch of them blew up a McDonald's or something.
Really?
And like,
they're getting ruder and ruder. Well, I'll tell you, Mike. A lot of times things can go to extremes. Fortunately, I mean, I have heard of straight edge kids, and I'm not really in the milieu in which I come across them. But talk about self righteousness and
right, exactly,
yeah,
right. It's like the other thing you're saying about. The idea with birth control pills—that's another example of extremism. People saying, "Well, we don't like what you're doing because it's immoral, or it's illegal, or it's fattening, or it's bad for your health. So we're going to go to the extreme and make and punish you for it." And it's like they take it to the ultimate extreme. It's like
I wonder if I have heard of some extreme activity on the part of straight edge kids, but I wonder if we're not maybe tarring all of them with a big brush. You know what I mean? In other words, to advocate things is okay. It's all right to advocate extreme things.
Right.
Like I advocate some extreme things, but I'm not going to try to force anybody to follow what I want. I just hope through what the Quakers call, is it gentle persuasion or friendly persuasion?
Gentle persuasion.
Gentle persuasion. Of course, they're gentler than I am, I think. But anyway, whatever. All right, Mike, thanks for telling us about it. I appreciate it. Anybody has any more information about that? I mean, are all these straight-edge kids that bad? Hope not. Here is Tom in Pontiac. Tom, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. This is Tom Miracle from Pontiac, Michigan. I have to say I totally agree with everything you say about homosexuality. And another thing on the birth control, it is used to control cysts on the ovaries because my fiance has that problem. So,
mm-hmm.
But everything I've listened to you since you came out and everything that you talk about is right on.
Well,
I agree with everything you say.
Well, can you imagine this? Here is somebody that I keep the phrase for these. There's this sort of buildup on the uterine wall. And somebody, a woman goes in there, it's been prescribed by a doctor, and somebody that thinks they got the word from God is going to say, I'm sorry, it's against my morals.
That's all right.
Yeah. And, Well, all right, thank you.
All right, you have a great night, man.
You too. Bye-bye. Okay, folks, I got your first name up here, and that's really all I need because of lots of things. So you need probably only to say, this is Peter from Detroit or something like that. That will do it. In fact, I introduce you. Is that here's Matt from Romeo. Matt, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hi.
Yes, I wanted to add a little bit about the straight edge thing you were talking about earlier.
Sure.
You said that, a lot of kids have been kind of tarred. Like, I understand the media has kind of perceived the whole movement as very violent. I mean, because as a lot of American media tends to do, it tends to portray things in a negative light.
Uh-huh.
Well, I've been straight edge for nearly 10 years. I'm 24 right now, and I've never taken extreme measures as, when I see somebody smoking on the street, I don't want to beat them up for it. You know, same thing with drinking. I don't see somebody drinking, and I want to beat them up for that. Like, it's more or less a personal choice, a religion,
mm-hmm.
I guess. But,
Well, and that includes sex as well?
I've never made that choice myself. It's like that in that sense too. So there's certain. Some people apply it to things in their life. For me, it's more of a punk rock thing.
Sure.
I guess it's more of like a political stance. drugs, well, or not drugs, I'm sorry, because drugs are illegal, but drinking, you know, like alcohol is a huge government, you know, tax and subsidized thing, as well as tobacco. It's kind of, you know, against that.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, most of that thing, I would say that with the exception of sex, you could probably do all right without any of it. I mean, in other words, without alcohol, certainly without smoking. I mean, I'm not a complete vegetarian, but I just eat sea animals, so I guess, which doesn't make me a vegetarian at all. But in other words, you could do all that and not hurt yourself one little bit. In fact, you might even want to be healthier, although they do say that, you know, like a glass of wine is good for you. I would miss drinking. I mean, I never get drunk, ever, but just as kind of a social deal with dinner and all. But, I mean, as long as people aren't trying to shove stuff down other people's throats, including, by the way, I don't even, in some ways, it wasn't even any of my business to ask. I was curious about you know, whether you abstain from sex, because, I mean, we should respect everyone's sexual choices, including no sex, right? He disappeared. Whatever, I didn't touch it. Okay, maybe... I don't know. Let's try Al from Inkster. Al, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hi.
How are you doing tonight?
Well, good. I hope I didn't cut Matt off. Anyways, sometimes it's, there's a ghost in the machine. But go ahead.
I want to talk about the timeline on Newsweek.
Okay.
Newsweek publishes a little blurb saying, you know, abuse of the Koran occurred in their prisons.
Well, was that? Specifically, they said that they had, quoting somebody who said that the Pentagon report that was going to come out would have information that a Koran was flushed down the toilet, which I thought was pretty weird. I mean, I don't think you couldn't flush a Koran down my toilet or a Bible or anything else, because it wouldn't go. Are you with me?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay,
are you with me?
I am. Go ahead.
Okay, so, you know, the rioting that's going on, they cite this, so, you know, the government cracks down on Newsweek, says you're exacerbating the rioting situation, it never happened, you know, so Newsweek publishes a retraction. What happens the next week? The government and the Pentagon come out and say, hey, guess what? Abuse of the Koran occurred.
Well, they just got a little urine on it. I mean, they didn't exactly flush
it
down the toilet.
It was the prisoners, actually, that was doing it, you know. It was.
Let me see. I was looking for this, where they came out and they said, oh, yeah, the Pentagon confirmed Friday evening after the network's evening news shows had aired. They said that was a coincidence, that a U.S. soldier had deliberately kicked a prisoner's holy book. The report also said prison guards had thrown water balloons in a cell block, just having a good time, causing an unspecified number of Qurans to get wet. And a guard's urine had splashed on a detainee and his Quran. An interpreter had stepped on a Quran during the interrogation, and a two-word obscenity.
In the Middle East is an insult.
Yeah, yeah. A two-word obscenity had been written in English on the inside cover of a Quran. So probably a lot of us would think, well, these folks are wrapped a little too tight. I mean, you know, but people do get kind of weird over symbols. I mean, think about these right-wing senators, these Republican senators, are still trying to get a flag-burning amendment. They want to amend the Constitution of the United States to say that you cannot destroy or alter or misuse a symbol. So what about
these people that choose them as, you know, bandanas and flags and part of their shirts or clothing?
Yeah,
isn't that a desecration?
Yeah, well, I don't know. It used to be. Now you get like bikini bottoms, so you're putting your tush on them. You know, you're sitting on it, right? I mean, these people.
And what did Jerry Rubin do during the '60s to protest America?
Yeah, he had a flag shirt, and they ripped it off him. I think it was Abby Hoffman, actually.
Yeah, it was Abby.
Yeah. And but you know, the real deal with this all is not even about this abuse of the Quran. It's that there is now a U.S. government policy that that easily defines the United States in terms that Amnesty International did. That is that the United States is a torture state, because from the highest level, from Bush and from Rumsfeld and the rest of them in the military, that they now permit torture. That there has been dozens of
gulag.
As they said, a gulag, which Cheney said he was offended And they question the veracity of...
Truman said, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. And I wish these guys would quit cooking.
I got you. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Now, here is what Bush said. Stung by Amnesty International's condemnation of U.S. detention facilities in Iraq and elsewhere overseas, the administration of President George W. Bush is reacting with indignation, even suggestions that terrorists are using the world's largest human rights organization. Now, first off, I would generally say where there's smoke, there's fire. I mean, if it's like in cities that had the most awful police brutality, Detroit, you know, back years ago when there was this all-white police force that just routinely beat the crap out of black citizens for absolutely no reason. Los Angeles, New York City, New Orleans. I mean, anybody that that wasn't blind, deaf, and dumb knew that there was immense and systematic police brutality that was protected by the upper echelon of officers and ignored by the political structure. Yet it was common to say police brutality, there is none, and to, you know, to allege there is simply undercuts the work that our fine men in blue are trying to accomplish. Well, of course, then it came out. I mean, still today, police forces across the United States pay out tens of millions of dollars. I don't want to have any total figure, but it could really wind up near $100 million a year in cases in settling police brutality. Routinely, the city of Detroit, strapped for cash, has to pay out $10 or $12 million a year for wrongful death and injury and whatever on the part of the Detroit police. Anyways, here's what Bush said. He says he's aware of the Amnesty International report, and he said, it's absurd. The United States is a country that promotes freedom around the world, unless you happen to be Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Uzbekistan or one of these other torture states that the United States ships prisoners off to be tortured, right? To be really awfully tortured. Here's what Bush says. It seemed like Amnesty based some of their decisions on the word and allegations by... Man, this guy can't talk, can he? It seemed like Amnesty based some of their decisions on the word and allegations by people who were held in detention, people who hate America, people who had been trained in some instances to disassemble. That means not tell the truth, Bush went on. And so it was an absurd report. It just is. Now... disassemble does not mean to not tell the truth. Dissemble does. You getting what I'm saying? He's saying disassemble, like take something apart. All right, disassemble the tent, we'll put it in the car and go back home from our camping trip. Dissemble, which is, I believe, spelling's not my high suit, but D-I-S-S-E-M-B-L-E. Dissemble means to lie and not tell the truth. So also Rumsfeld was highly indignant. He said sometimes prisoners have been mistreated, sometimes grievously, but there's no policy. It's not there's not a gulag. Gulag means like an archipelago, right? Like a what would you call it? A connected an archipelago geographically are islands that are, you know, kind of in a long series. So. Well, but when you start putting together the prisons in Afghanistan, Guantanamo, and in Iraq, and know that there's thousands and thousands of people in there, particularly in Iraq, that are being held without even the rudiments of what is considered by international law to be proper treatment of prisoners, this is bad. Let's see. He says, where is this? The recent allegation that the U.S. military is running a gulag at Guantanamo Bay is so reprehensible. That's what he says. It's absolutely reprehensible. Here's what Michael Ratner says. Michael Ratner is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Constitutional rights? God, he must be some commie or something like that, right? They still have commies? Maybe they do. What do they call people now? Anyways, here's what he said. He wrote a book. In fact, I interviewed him about it. And played it on this show, Guantanamo, What the World Should Know. He said today, Rumsfeld directly approved the use of dogs, stress positions, stripping, hooding, poking, removal of religious objects, a series of interrogations techniques that amount to torture. The FBI has documented the use of grabbing people's genitals and smearing menstrual blood in an effort to violate detainees' religious beliefs. The U.S. government is not holding people accountable. In our effort to bring these violators of international human rights to justice, the Center for Constitutional Rights is suing Rumsfeld for torture in Guantanamo, and we are using the idea that leaders at the highest level of government are responsible for their crimes. All right, let's take a break. In the meantime, you can call up here at 313-298-WRIF. Right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Bill Bonds with a commercial. If you're near or far-sighted and you want to throw away those glasses forever, I know a doctor you should see. Dr. Rescombati. Phone number 1-877. Then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 1-877. You see more. The equipment, the finest high-tech equipment ever made. Price $999 per eye. So don't fall for those $200 prices you hear being tossed around on the radio. Cows don't fly. Neither do those prices, unless your daddy is an eye doctor and you're getting a freebie. Dr. S. Kambadi, no doctor we know of has a better success rate. Procedure is fast, safe, cost $999 per eye. Virtually painless, you're in and out, maybe 40 minutes. Procedure itself, maybe 5. When it's over, you'll want to kiss your glasses goodbye and hug the doctor. Or maybe you guys will just want to give him a hi-fi, shake hands with him, walk away, and see a whole new world. See ya.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for big money. The OSI Pro Series WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Championship Series is underway, and there's still time to enter to win the $1,500 Series Championship. Sign up now for the Bass Championship going out of Lake Erie Metro Park on July 30th. Slots will fill up fast, so get your entry in now. Compete for thousands of dollars in cash and prizes, including the DMF Bait Award for the kid under 16 landing the largest fish on live bait. It's all going to be given away to the best fishing team in town, so sign up now by calling 248-591-6841 or go to WRIF.com for an entry form. There will be fun for everyone at the post-event party at Big Al Sports Grill, so call 248-591-6841 to become the OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Brought to you by OSI Pro Series, the DMF Bait Company, Big Al Sports Grill, and 101 WRIF.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Hey, Tigers fans, this summer, why sit at home when you could sit at home? Fight, that is. Now is a great time to catch all the fun and excitement happening at every Detroit Tigers home game. You'll see plenty of homers by Pudge Rodriguez, Dimitri Young, Carlos Guillen, and all your favorite players. But a trip to Comerica Park means more than just baseball. While the Tigers are driving home runs, you could drive home in a brand new car during the Chevy Cobalt Drive One Home Giveaway, sponsored by your Detroit area Chevy dealers. Just buy a ticket to select Friday or Saturday night home games, and you could drive one out of here. Looking for a surefire hit? Hey, don't miss Friday and Saturday night fireworks, sponsored by Pepsi and Verizon Wireless. And with a weekend value pack, that's four tickets, four hot dogs, and four Pepsis for just $59. And you'll want to bring everyone from home. So for great giveaways like autographed balls, bobbleheads, collector cards, and jerseys, and for great baseball, this summer, catch a Tigers game. For tickets, call 248-25-TIGER or visit DetroitTigers.com and make Comerica Park your home away from home game.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riffed rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff Rocks.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. I'm being videotaped, so I'm going to be very, 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 very self-conscious. Let's see. What are we talking about? Whether these self-righteous
I don't know, guardians of our ethical and moral and religious life have the right to deny people treatment because there's just this bill that apparently has been passed. I hope it didn't make it through the Senate. Maybe it did. That would allow practitioners in Michigan to say that they're not going to fill prescriptions for like birth control stuff. They wouldn't have to treat gay people if they didn't want to. This is just terrible. Anyway, let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Frank in Detroit. Frank, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How's it going?
It's going going good. Thanks.
Good.
What's up?
Good. I just I heard you talking about torture, and I just want to share a story.
Sure.
I was in Indianapolis this past weekend here on Saturday. I went down for a demonstration against the Interstate 69 construction that's down there. It's a NAFTA superhighway that they want to build from Canada to Mexico. They have a few segments built. They're working on building a new train, one in Indiana. Anyway, but
wait. Back us up. Tell us this whole story. So what's wrong with having a highway from Canada? We can go jump on this thing in Detroit and just drive right down to Mexico City. That sounds pretty cool.
Well, if it was that simple, that would probably, it wouldn't be as bad. But the problem is, I mean, it's many layers of problems with this thing. First off, it's about transporting goods from Mexico up to here, transporting jobs down and around, and all, you know, transferring around, where these corporations will be just searching around for wherever they can find the cheapest place to build their stuff, build it, put it back on the freeway. Ship it to here, you know, ship the frame to the next plant and put the thing together and provide it for all of us, you know. So it's their way of carting around these factories and manufacturing and, you know, causing great destabilization in our communities.
Also, does it have any, all of a sudden I was thinking about roads, how about environmental impact?
Oh, this is atrocious. It seems like the Indiana Department of Transportation connect the dots with, like, wetlands and forest preserves in the southern Indiana region. It's very hilly and forested down there, and there's some big tracks of it, and they decided to find the largest tracks and just go right through the center of it.
Well, has there been any public debate about this? I haven't even heard hardly anything about it.
They've actually been, the groups down there have been fighting this project for over 10 years now, and it's slowly sort of creeping forward. The big stumbling block is money. It's going to cost $2 billion to build this new terrain section of highway down there, and they don't really have the money. They want to rob it from the schools and from the other public programs that, you know.
Hey, how about Medicare or Medicaid? We could always kind of take that away from the poor and the elderly and use that for a big road.
Sure, I mean, roads are more important,
All right, anyway, so how does this all tie in with torture?
Well, what happened was we were demonstrating down there. We had a march, and we were just kind of doing some public outreach and stuff, and then the police decided that it was too much. There was a point in it where someone decided to use some spray paint, and I guess it happened to be on the Capitol building. I don't know who it was. It doesn't really matter, there's a little spray paint, they can clean it up. But the police just freaked out and surrounded everyone. And they jumped on, one person had a video camera, they jumped on her, knocked her to the ground, beat her up, and caused an asthma attack. Didn't provide her any sort of medical treatment about that. Their treatment was to sit her in the hot sun for about 2 hours with handcuffs on. They tasered another woman who was standing there saying, "Hey, what are you doing this for?" So they tasered her.
Taser, I mean those kind of those little guns that have this electrical line that goes out, right?
Yeah, shoots the wires out and stick in you and runs a heavy voltage through it. You know, they shot her with one of those. Then two gentlemen said to the officer who just shot this woman, "What are you doing?" And he pepper sprayed them in their face for just asking, "Why did you do that?" And all we're doing is just having a demonstration here.
Well, I got to tell you, Frank, there's probably any number of people that are saying, "Come on,
Police in America don't do anything like that. You must have done something to provoke them, or you must have represented a danger. You got to remember now, these, well, tell me, like, how is everybody dressed? Because obviously we know the police are dressed in very protective gear, oftentimes when they go to demonstrations, in order to give the impression that the demonstrators are dangerous. They're decked out in these, you know, like they were going to be facing, you know, like the armed insurgents in Iraq.
Yeah, you know, that's what they look like. They look like stormtroopers there. And it was pretty crazy. I mean, the person that was tasered is like an 18-year-old woman, 120 pounds, and it's a big dude, a big cop, you know, 200-some-odd pound, tall, muscular cop. And, you know, and according to their story, that she jumped on this police officer, and we were all there, and he didn't and she didn't. It was, they're just fabricating the story. The police are now to try to cover their butts for torturing this woman.
Was it being videoed? Usually everything is being videoed.
Yeah, I think so. Things were a little hectic at that point. I'm not sure who was videotaping. There was an undercover police agent, and we really didn't have anything to hide. We just wanted to demonstrate, you know. We had a pretty good feeling that this guy in plain clothes that was following us around with a video camera was a police officer, but no one had made any attempts to, like, try to stop him because, you know, we're not hiding nothing.
I'll tell you, Frank, there has been this major effort, as you may or may not know, on the part of the government to characterize a lot of environmental groups as domestic terrorists. They leave off. There was this Homeland Security report which listed a lot of environmental groups, but mm-hmm. completely left off all these right-wing terrorist groups, the type that Timothy McVeigh and people were connected with. So, they always need some internal dangerous enemy. So, with the communists gone, it might be. I was going to say you guys, but I would certainly include myself among active environmentalists.
Oh, I think that that you hit the nail on the head there. You know, they're looking for someone for people to be afraid of and to paint. An evil picture about and justify getting these big monies so that they can have all their
and the guys that get the tasers, they like doing it. That's why they do it. They're not like, oh, what an awful thing. Because oftentimes, I mean, if you go to the taser website, they'll show how officers were able to control some psychotic person that weighed 280 pounds and so they didn't have to shoot him or anything like that, and how this is an advance. But these things are used very frequently inside of precinct houses and inside of prisons as torture instruments.
Yeah, while we were sitting, there was 25 of us arrested, right around 25 of us arrested down there.
So you were arrested too?
Yeah, I was arrested. We got to sit in the precinct for about 16, 17 hours. They just made us sit in these hard plastic chairs for the whole time. Didn't give us, basically nowhere to lay down. One toilet for about 150, 200 people to use. It was all, of course, messed and everything, and it was pretty foul. You know, there was one guy that came in who was kind of intoxicated, and they put him in one of the padded rooms, and I'm not sure what they did, but they went in there with a nurse and made him be quiet. So that's pretty crazy. We're just talking to the prisoners there, you know, about, I'd say, at least a third of the people that came in that were, you know, not involved with the demonstration, that were just there for general offenses or warrants or whatever, were tasered.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty heavy use of it in Indianapolis. They're going nuts with it, you know.
So what were you all charged with?
We haven't been charged yet, actually. They got a special extension to review videotapes, and we have to go back down there on Thursday, and they're going to try to they're going to recharge us to us then.
Yeah.
They said disorderly conduct at first, but then they decided they didn't want to just do that, and now. So it's up in the air. Maybe they'll drop the charges because they just kind of rounded everyone up. And, they picked up people that look like protesters from far away, too.
Well, one of the things I mentioned that, I don't even have that. In fact, I might. I was talking earlier about how the city of Detroit, with all of its financial woes, usually has to pay out about $10 or $12 million a year for police misconduct.
Yeah.
And the cops had to pay out a ton of money for the way they acted at the, what was that? When was the Philadelphia Republican
That was 2000, wasn't it?
Yeah, 2000, yeah.
They had to pay out tons of money for that. The cops in Miami, that under the same police chief, this guy Timoney, who always unleashes police violence against unarmed demonstrators. It's always like RoboCops versus some 20-year-old kid in flip-flops and shorts, right?
Yeah, that's what it looked like down there. That's what it looked like.
So they always wind up, and always, initially it's presentation, it's protesters clash with police. And and in fact, I was in Miami for these demonstrations in, what was it, late 2003, right? Yeah. And we were watching television, and because this was all going on, and these cops are just beating the crap out of people, and they're showing it on television, mm-hmm. and the commentators are saying, I know this could look like the police are actually initiating violence and that the demonstrators aren't doing anything, but, you know, Frank, Jim, you know, the oftentimes these people represent more of a danger than it appears. Yeah. Well, listen, I should move on. Is there any way that people can hook on to this, either get some information about what this NAFTA Superhighway I-696, what that represents, or to the kind of efforts that you're involved in?
Sure. You know, they can look at the web if you have internet access. You can go to roadless-summer.org, and that'll give you a lot of information about I-69 and the efforts that, of the groups that are down there that are working on it for the summer.
Let me just repeat it. It's roadless, like R-O-A-D-L-E-S-S?
Yes.
Then what?
Dash.
Dash or hyphen, yeah.
Yeah, hyphen, yeah. Summer.
Summer. Okay.
Yeah, so .org. And then, you know, you can, you know, if you want to find out locally what people are doing about this, the northern end of it here in Detroit is the DIFT project, which is the Intermodal Freight Terminal Project. There's some public meetings coming up here at the end of June that NDOT is proposing. They want to build a train-to-truck transfer stations here in the city of Detroit, down on the southwest side, run 16,000 trucks through the city.
Well, do this for me. Actually, oftentimes this is there's so much information, and the reason there's so much information is none of this stuff makes it into the mainstream corporate press. Mm-hmm. Email me this,
okay,
and I will review it, and I think from previous knowledge I have of this, I'll put it on my website.
Sure, that would be great. Yeah, because I can't remember the website for the DIFT project, you know, the activist groups and stuff like that off the top of my head.
Well, keep us informed.
Maybe. Yeah, I'll pass that on to you so you can put it up.
And call us next week and let us know what happened with the charges and all.
Okay.
All right, Frank, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right,
Frank.
Bye-bye. Ah, man, tasered for demonstrating. Oh, let's go to Maurice in Inkster. We got a lot of people calling from Inkster. Hey, Maurice, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
I'm doing good.
Hey, with the elections coming up in Detroit with the 9, the council seats being open, and what is your personal opinion about that bum they call a mayor?
Well, he's not doing real well. They just did this poll. In fact, here I just pulled out this news item. It says Detroit mayor trails in new poll. Well, I was going to say I would hope so. I think it's in. There's a lot of reasons that he not be, pardon me, rewarded for his behavior. Because one of the things that happens, Maurice, is people begin to say the reason that Detroit is in such bad condition is because of Kwame Kilpatrick. I mean, he may not have helped the situation, but it's that the deterioration that's going on in general in our big cities and our states and to a lot of our communities, suburban communities, is not the fault of one person, but rather the structural decline because all this money is going to Bush's wealthy friends and these corporations. That's what I think.
Hey, one more question, Peter. Do you think it was a party at the Maneuvering Mansion? Because a friend was telling me it was like three girls attending the party.
I was there.
And guess what he said? These three girls wound up getting killed.
Killed?
Yeah, they wound up getting killed. And I didn't really, you know, he told me a friend of his got all the newspaper articles and stuff. I was just wondering why this has not been brought up to the media, but then he's swooping behind the party.
I don't know, Maurice. It sounds like something out of an Elmore Leonard novel. But, hey, you never can tell with the big city politics. All right, thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF.
A lot of people listening across the country and across the world. Bill is listening in Columbia, Maryland. He says he's been listening over the web for a couple of years, loves the show. The so-called Downing Street Memo. Every person in America, thank you for bringing this up, Bill. Every person in America should go, yeah, the Downing Street Memo. And it, even to say it's baloney. I mean, it's not baloney, but you can even to have an opinion on it. But I'm willing to bet that probably 80% of you listening have never heard of the Downing Street Memo. Well, the Downing Street Memo proves concretely what you've heard charged against the Bush administration, that it had decided to attack Iraq, and that the intelligence was essentially fixed. That's what it says in this memo. It's an English memo. And they fixed it to justify the war. At the same time, he outright, Bush, being lied to the American public, saying no decision had been made to go to war and that every other option would be exhausted before using military force. This is quoting from Bill's letter from Columbia, Maryland, his email message. Pardon me, pollen. High pollen count today. This is enough for impeachment. This is a high crime and misdemeanor, and typical of a Republican administration. Just like the Reagan administration violated the Constitution, violated the laws of the country by being involved, by sending armaments to Iran. I mean, they were giving stuff to Iraq as well, but they were also selling armaments to Iran at the same time. They were taking money and sending it down to these mercenary gangsters that they were promoting to overthrow elected governments in Central America. And then that takes us back to Nixon. Another crook. Remember, he said, I am not a crook. Well, he had to quit before he got impeached. In fact, they were about to vote on articles of impeachment. I don't think, you know, someone was criticizing me for, well, I remember, for not knowing something. Again, folks, I do this all off the top of my head. We don't have any, you know, four producers running around here getting up information for me. But so this is all off the top of my head. But anyways, there's this pattern of lawbreakers, violation of international law and international norms by the succession of Republican presidents. Nixon, Reagan, Bush, two. What did I see here? If I had my third producer, he or she would have been putting up the show how Bush one also did that as well. But here, damn, this stuff. Never mind. There's this, like, yellow pollen, if you didn't hear me, that's just everywhere, and it seems like a good part of it's in my throat. Mike Gravel, is it, or Gravel? I can't even remember. Anyways, the U.S. Senator from Alaska from 1969 to 1981, he said about Watergate and the Nixon departure, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, was the prevailing song in 1975, 30 years ago, when Nixon resigned. That's not what Gravel said. I think it's Gravel. He says, W. Mark Felt, the assistant director of the FBI during the Watergate scandal, has admitted to being deep throat. He was the source of an important information for Washington Post investigative reporters Woodward and Bernstein. Senator Gravel says Felt's revelations and tips kept the investigation alive by pulling back the shroud of secrecy hiding the criminal activities of the Nixon White House. This is a senator saying this. Felt should receive the American Medal of Freedom for his courage and patriotism in defense of our democracy. The greatest threat, says the senator, to democracy is secrecy. It is a generic flaw of our representative system of government. Secrecy is endemic to government. In other words, you know, it's kind of like epidemic. It is the device government officialdom uses to hide the truth and to manipulate the media and the public, and is the slippery slope leading to tyranny, so says this ex-senator. Here is what Pat Buchanan says. He was a speechwriter for Nixon and a consultant, a White House special consultant to Nixon. So he was in bed with this criminal president who is responsible for the deaths of probably a couple million Vietnamese and probably 30,000 American troops as well. So he, Pat Buchanan, attacks Mark Felt, and he says, the great mystery who was deep throat reaches its anticlimax. It turns out to be a toady who oversaw black bag jobs for J. Edgar, violated his oath, and out of malice and spite leaked the fruits of an honest FBI investigation to the nest of Nixon haters at the Washington Post, then lied about it for 30 years. I mean, he lied about it and said he wasn't deep throat. And actually, the person, Carol, who sent it to me, said, do you think Buchanan is angry that Felt helped take down his hero? Well, yeah. So the Pat Buchanans of the world, and you may have seen some of these creeps on television, these apologists for this criminal in the White House, Richard Nixon, they're mad that this information came out about all of the misdeeds of the Nixon White House. That's what they're angry about. They want to keep everything secret. They want us to just to be a bunch of dumbbells that are mesmerized by media. And unfortunately, there is a segment. Remember, this is some of the people that can be fooled all the time. They're mostly Republicans, about 98% conservatives. And again, though, it's not even so much it's they're fooled. It's self-delusion. It's, what does Chomsky call that? Willful ignorance. Right. All right. Here is James in Westland. James, Peter Werby, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Pete.
Hi.
I want to change the subject
sure.
a little bit, keeping it on radical people who want to try to police your lives, but not on Republicans per se, because I don't know this guy's political
sure, go
alignment.
Ahead. Go ahead.
Have you heard of the name Jack Thompson?
Jack Thompson, no.
This is a trial lawyer representing two Alabama cops who were killed by a teenager who played the Grand Theft Auto game series. Okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, his whole argument here is that Grand Theft Auto inspired him to kill these cops. Okay, that's like saying...
Huh?
You playing a video game now want to go out and kill people.
This is the defense. I mean, this is about as clear as mud.
Yeah. Okay, I'm with you on this.
Okay.
Okay. And there's an interview in Electron Gaming Monthly, and I'll quote here. Eventually, there is going to be a Columbine to the factor of 10, a slaughter in a school by a crazed gamer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This quote hurts my mind. Really. This is worse than anything that's come out of Bush's mouth.
Kind of hurts my mind, too, but probably for different reasons. I think we're going to, this is going to be, too, you know what you should do? Email me all this, James, because I'm not following this in the slightest. Email me and the link and everything at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We'll be right back.
This is WRIN.com. Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Motor City Harley Davidson Harley Fest 2005, presented by 101 WRIF, Molson, and Jerome Duncan Ford. Your chance to nab a 2005 Harley Davidson Custom XL 883 Sportster.
Yeah.
And park it in the driveway next to a sweet new Ford Harley Davidson F250 truck. And the glove box stuffed with $5,000 in cold hard cash.
Compliments of Rock Financial.
Just keep your radio locked on 101 The Riff to win a key, along with tickets to see Tesla Friday, June 17th. Also, listen for details on Harley Bike Nights around the Motor City, where you can grab a key in person. Harley Fest 2005, presented by Motor City Harley Davidson.
Feel the freedom at the number one dealer, located in Farmington Hills.
Molson,
making friends since 1786.
Jerome Duncan Ford,
Michigan's number one Ford dealer.
Security provided by Gallagher Security. Trained professionals for crowd safety and management.
101 WRIF. Rocks.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants. Like Clubhouse Tavern, located in the fabulous Fisher Building, offering great food at great prices. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to wrif.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at wrif.com.
Here on the Riff, then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. This is our second hour, by the way, so thanks for joining us. And let's see, 1 a.m. Eastern Time. Boy, my throat is tickling. It is tickling because there's too much pollen in. I was just, hold on here. Man, these microphones, you can... I don't know, what do they call these things? I just think, you know, you got to, like, really be up on them like this. But, I mean, I turned my back and was a few feet away. Anyways, it's on the top of the hour, so I probably should reset everything, as they say in the biz. I'm Peter Werby. You can call us up at 313-298-WRIF, or you can email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. You know, let me think. That usually... I'm getting about 50 emails an hour. I've gotten one. Now, I'm not trying to solicit them because I want that to be available for you, but it's hard for me to field them all. So would someone, let's see, just I don't want everybody, you know, I'm going to say send me an email. I'll wind up getting 1,500 of them. So would somebody in Washtenaw County, Michigan, email me and say, yeah, here's an email, and... So you can tell it works. Maybe it doesn't work because Yahoo is having some problems. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. While Bush and Cheney are giving optimistic assessments of the situation in Iraq, a fresh wave of car bombings and other attacks killed 80 U.S. soldiers and more than 700 Iraqis last month alone and prompted Iraqi leaders to appeal to the administration for greater help. Pardon me. We have already spent, what's the figure now? Actually, Boy, that's weird. The figure is right out of my brain. $300 billion? Is that too much? I better look at my own website and figure it out. But every time when we hear about anything happening, we're paying for it. We don't have the money to do everything we need to do here, and we're giving away this money. Well, Secretary of War Rumsfeld... he was over in Singapore, in an unusually blunt public critique, no less, of China, said Saturday that Beijing's military spending threatened the delicate security balance in Asia and called for an emphasis instead on political freedom and open markets. So the real concern that China is spending all this money on weaponry. Doesn't like that. It's the third largest expenditures in the world. And he said, since no nation threatens China, one wonders, why this growing investment? Yeah? Well, what country has the largest expenditure? That's us. And we don't have any enemies. We got some guys that do irregular warfare and sabotage that turned out at one particular time to be catastrophically awful for this nation. But no nation threatens the U.S. And yet the expenditures on the military grow and grow. In fact, we could do this. I hadn't even thought about this. that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, in an unusually blunt public critique of America, said Washington's military spending threatened the delicate security balance in Asia and called for an emphasis instead on political freedom and open markets. Since no nation threatens the U.S., one wonders why this growing investment, Mr. Rumsfeld said. So we turn it around like that, it gives you a whole different perspective. Well, one of the reasons that China probably wants to invest so much in armaments, and countries that are developing and countries that are poor, that doesn't do real well for them. The United States invests a lot in military, not just for political dominance, but also this is what happens. It's this transfer of private funds, the money we make, to the state, and then it's given to these war manufacturers. And we always manage to find enemies. And if there weren't any enemies, we wouldn't have a war economy to the extent that we do. So, why would China want all this weaponry? Well, it's fearful of the United States. It's fearful that the United States, under Bush, is talking about putting weapons in space. It's fearful that the United States wants permanent bases in Iraq, as many as 12, which again puts it and in Uzbekistan and in Eastern Europe and in how many other countries around the world. Because for most of us, we think, well, gee, all our motives are good and kind, and we're just trying to stop communism or whatever else is the enemy of the day. And we wouldn't hurt anybody. We never do anything. Other countries don't see us as so benign. And we could probably argue all night and day as to whether the United States motives are good or bad or a mixture. But mostly it's about perception. And when the United States is trying to dominate what will soon be an extraordinarily scarce resource across the world, that is oil, and that was the main purpose of a lot of purposes, but the main purpose, of course, of invading the Middle East, of going so far from our homeland to make war, to destroy this country, to kill tens of thousands of civilians, to lose, almost 1,700 of our men so far. In fact, we probably have about 15,000 casualties so far. They realize that this is about energy war at a level beyond actual combat. That Asia, and China in particular, as a developing nation, needs oil. And who controls it? And as we reach or have reached peak production, that is, we've gotten the most that we're going to get out of the oil reserves of the world, and it starts going downward, he who controls, or it which controls, the oil supply of the world is going to have other countries by the cojones. Correct? So, the other thing is, the United States has a penchant for invading countries. Usually they're small and without the weapons of mass destruction because, they don't invade North Korea. They, when I'm talking about the Bush administration, I guess it's us, isn't it, since we're paying the freight. We don't invade North Korea because they do have weapons of mass destruction, and we did invade Iraq because they didn't. So, what we need to do, and if you had a country that wasn't run essentially by psychos, they seem pretty normal. I mean, they don't really to me, but I mean, they seem pretty normal. They seem like most rich people bosses, that kind of folk. They have that kind of command style, like they always know what's going on. They screw up everything, and they have throughout their lives, all their businesses. But they always get bailed out because they're rich. I was just telling somebody, I haven't used this analogy in a long time. Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney and all these people, when I went to Michigan State, when I went to college, they were like these rich frat rats that did everything from knock up their girlfriends, or they get drunk on Saturday night and wreck their cars, they get in big fights, and then, well, what the hell? They'd be back in class on Monday because they never had to pay the consequences for the mistakes that they made. Like, there's no mistakes for this catastrophic failure on September 11th of intelligence. There's no price to be paid for having lied about weapons of mass destruction. There's nothing like that. So we have these guys. If you're ringing, by the way, hold on. We'll be right to your call. 313-298-WRIF. Pardon me. I was talking about getting distracted earlier. That cut me off my train of thought.
that many ways they look like they're these rational people, but every policy they carry out is totally irrational. That for one thing, they're control freaks because they're these total authoritarian personalities that have no use for democracy other than slogans. And when they don't win elections, they just steal them, and so it's a lot of noise about it. But what would make a lot of sense is instead of making war everywhere in preparations for war and increasing the size of the war machine, since we don't have any enemies, you don't need nukes in space for Osama bin Laden, pardon me, you need good police work. Maybe they've even done that. I mean, there hasn't been any more terrorist attacks in a long time. There hasn't been any terrorist attacks at this country. So maybe the cops, the actual people that are out there doing the stuff, maybe they're doing their work. But you don't need a Star Wars for terrorists. You need that as an aggressive, offensive weapon against other countries. And China knows this. So rather than making war and preparations for war, wouldn't it make sense as if we went about making peace? And if we're the biggest country in the world, if we control so much of the armaments and the wealth and all that, certainly, if there was a will to do it, it could occur. It could occur. The second thing is to end poverty. And we can do that as well. There is so much wealth in this world, it's being hogged by a minuscule percentage of the world's population. Things are going the other way now. Both in this country, the wealth of the upper 10%, I just saw this in the New York Times today, the wealth of the upper 10% is increasing, particularly these 134,000 families that represent 0.1% of the population. Their wealth is increasing considerably. The Fortune 400, of which you need $750 million to gain entree, their wealth is increasing. The bottom 90%, that's everybody listening, I'll bet. Maybe there's one super rich guy, but mostly I'm willing to bet 100% of us, the bottom 90%, our overall income and personal wealth is decreasing. All right? So we got to end poverty, not even talking about a loss of wealth, which is continuing with, for instance, the middle class. And wages are, in real dollars, decreasing as well. Overall, even if you made more money than you did last year, doesn't make, we're talking about the aggregate numbers. So we have to end poverty throughout the world. Wars often are caused by poverty. A lot of what we see in Africa and Asia and what have you, a lot of the social disruption in countries around the world is caused by this absolutely horrific maldistribution of wealth. And the third thing, maybe this should even be the first and make the other two a lot easier, is end dependence on fossil fuels. We can do it. And we could invent the atom bomb in a matter of, a year and a half or something. We could find ways through alternate fuel sources and through conservation that we wouldn't have to fight a war in Iraq for oil. We wouldn't have to see China as a potential enemy or China see us as a potential enemy. But the people that currently run the show in this country and worldwide have no capacity to do that. They are absolutely incapable and inept, have no will, and have no mindset to do it. As long as these people continue to control the world, and that probably consumes the majority of Democrats and all that, I'm not letting them off the hook. It's not like they have any grand ideas for transforming the planet into what it should be. They're marginally better than what this crew we have in there now, but they're not. I mean, a grand plan for another world other than the one that we currently have. And that goes back. I haven't said a bad thing about conservatives today, have I? Well, here we go. Conservatives want to conserve the world as it's currently constituted, with all its wars, all its disease, all of its poverty, all of its hideous urban slums, and I'm not talking about Detroit. I'm talking about Mexico City and these growing huge slums in Africa and Asia. All right, my ideas. How about yours? 313-298-WRIF. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Here's Darren in Inkster. Hey, Darren, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Good. Thanks for waiting so long.
Yeah, I just want to say a lot of the things that you're talking about, Peter, and I just want to say I really enjoy your show. I've been listening to it for the past couple of years, and I really like your email. I mean, your website.
Well,
and I just want to say that a lot of the things you're talking about, bro, I have learned in my graduate classes. I'm a recent graduate from Western Michigan University, and last semester I had a social policy class, and we talked a lot about the formation of policies. A lot of things that are going on, like you were saying before, Peter, is just simply bad policy, horrible policy. And a lot of it has to deal with these characters called the social conservatives.
Uh-huh.
And these social conservatives, for the most part, are creating these policies and, you know, with this ideology and whatnot. And it comes down to, I think, in a broader perspective, a broader picture of the social construction of reality, whereby you have a collective of people, you know, such as like these social conservatives who try to create some type of create an illusion, a reality for the masses to adhere to. You understand what I'm saying?
Sure, go ahead.
And so it's kind of like, you know, and this has been going on for a very long time, in a sense that, you know, you need some type of construct of reality to you know, justify your existence on, you know, on this earth and whatnot. And so you have, you know, like you think about, like, you know, okay, so somebody's gay, whatever, they choose to live their life, or, you know, somebody choose to smoke marijuana or whatnot, or whatever they choose, they're different. You know, they may consider them to be deviants from the norm. You know what I'm saying? So they try to instill certain policies and whatnot, and engage in certain types of therapeutic, you know, behaviors. And therapy, I'm not saying, like, you know, Sigmund Freud.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, like, you know, okay, to try to persuade you back into, you know, the mainstream, like, this is what you're supposed to do. And then if you do not do that, then, you know, for the most part, they engage in nihilism, whereby, you know, it could be used, like, say, for instance, put you in jail or kill you. That's the worst form of nihilism. You know what I'm saying? So these are the types of things that I've learned to help me, like, maintain a level of, like, man, what the heck is going on? You know what I'm saying?
I do, indeed. And, you know, I'll tell you, I just spent the week in New York City. And talk about a diverse population on everything from citizen and non-citizen, every race in the world, every sexual preference, every lifestyle, and every mode of dress, from, you know, $2,000 suits to foot-high mohawks.
Right.
I mean, and a lot of, see, that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. They like everything exactly the same. And they get nervous when they're around people that aren't exactly like them. But that's not the way of the world. And you can't have a modern interactive world on one hand, and on the other hand, expect there to be this, you know, homogenized world. I mean, you know, go. If there are, no matter who you are, if you want everybody the same, there's probably some place where you can go where everyone is just like you. And the people that feel like they should do it and stop bothering the rest of us that like a diverse world.
Right. And, you know, this is really sad because, you know, it just brings everything down. It brings everything down to a screeching halt, you know what I'm saying? Because it's like, okay, what I'm doing is wrong. You know, I'm an individual. I choose to do this, you know what I'm saying? And it's like eats away at everything you consider to be like your individual self, so to speak, you know, and like, I feel the need to do some traveling. You know, I never really got a chance to do a lot of traveling, you know, growing up. And so what I'm going to try to do, you know, as another goal in my life, next year I'm going to try to go to Japan.
Really?
You know what I'm saying? And, like, do some teaching English and stuff and just meet some of the people, because it's just like, I don't know how long I can, you know, take being in the country that is ran by this character right now. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I hope so far we got a constitution that says he can't have a third term, but who knows? It, well, listen, best of luck on your plans to travel, and you're going about it right. I mean, I've known people with, for instance, and I don't know what your financial situation, but I've known people with very, very limited circumstances, and I'm thinking of one particular couple even. They said, we're going to India, and I'm thinking, where in the hell are these people going to get money to go to India? I mean, that's not exactly cheap, but they just saved their lunch money and went off to India for a month. So, Darren, best of luck. Thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot. man. I'll continue to listen to your website.
I appreciate it. Yeah, the website, by the way, is peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. And, oh, we lost somebody that was on there for a long time. I'm going to take Andrew, who's been waiting a real long time as well. Andrew, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
I was just calling from, you were talking a long while ago about the birth control.
Sure. Well, yeah, let me just tell people, we were talking about how some druggists now will not fill prescriptions for birth control or what have you. Yeah.
Yeah, my girlfriend actually had cancer a couple of years ago, and her oncologist prescribed her to get birth control because, as you know, chemotherapy kills off all your blood cells and everything.
Sure.
And when that time of the month came around, you know, she would bleed out all of her transfusions, so she had to get a transfusion every other day. And the oncologist prescribed her that birth control to regulate her blood flow, so had she not had that, you know, she'd have to use up all the blood transfusions every other day, you know.
Wow. So, yeah, we were talking about the medical use of them other than just as contraceptives. But think about this, and think about, I mean, I'm not even so much addressing it to you, but to all of us, that you have somebody that wants to have sexual intimacy either within their family accentuate love and connection between a couple, or just somebody that wants to, have a woman who wants to have sex on her terms. I mean, it doesn't matter to me. It's none of my business, right?
Yeah.
But these people in a drugstore will decide it's their business. They will decide, I am not going to give it to them because, this is the ultimate in busybodies. Absolutely crazy.
Well, the thing for me is I don't think that we should have the right to tell anybody what they can and cannot do, you know, and I don't think that anybody should be given the right to tell us that what we are doing is morally wrong, so I will not serve you because I just don't like it.
Well,
you know?
I'll tell you, Andrew, the majority of us don't, and usually in a country that becomes more and more closed and run in a more and more dictatorial manner, the majority of people don't go for it. I mean, if you look at the elections, which you may know of, and let me see if I remember, in 1932 in Germany, about a third of the people voted for the Nazis. You know,
yeah.
The same thing if you probably put Adolf Hitler up here.
Yeah.
A third of the people would vote for him as well. And the majority of people voted for left-wing parties in that election. But these, because they never take no for an answer, and they don't have any respect for democratic the process, they don't have any respect for democratic process unless they win. When they lose, then they want to change the rules.
Yeah, and then the rules get changed, and then we all suffer for it.
That's right. Well, all right. Thank you very much for that. I think it was an important piece of information. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for calling. We've been trying to call earlier, 313-298-WRIF. Hey, speaking about elections, the United States has put up a proposal in the Organization of American States about having to do about elections. Now, the Organization of American States, the OAS, which is all the countries of North America, Organization of American States, must be. I mean, I'm trying to remember whether Canada's in it. Yeah, I think so. Everybody's in it except for Cuba. They won't let the United States won't let Cuba in it. But now, most of the countries, other than the United States, I'm trying to think numerically. But anyways, there's tons of countries now run by leftists. And big ones like Brazil, and there's a liberal party in Canada and Ecuador, and where else? Where else have there been big ones just recently? My brain stopped functioning. But anyway, there is. But for some reason or other, Bush still thinks the OAS is this extension of American foreign policy, like all these alliances like NATO and what have you. But anyway, the American proposal to create a committee at the Organization of American States that would monitor the quality of democracy and exercise of power in Latin America is facing a hostile reception from many countries, in part because it's being viewed as a thinly veiled effort to attack Venezuela. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number, and there's open lines. You may want to grab one now, and our producer and phone screener, Jay Hudson, will get your call. And it was introduced by Roger F. Noriega. No relationship to the American asset turned enemy. What was his name? Manuel Noriega? Well, you remember the guy that was the good pal of Reagan and Bush until they decided they needed a little country to invade and did that. Anyway, he said Where is this quote? Oh, yeah. All we are doing is creating a mechanism, a procedure, he said. We do think there should be accountability when countries violate the OAS's democratic charter. So I don't know. I think it might be cool to have that. But how about this? What about the U.S.? What about the 2000 election? Wouldn't the U.S., given the fact that Bush won the majority of the popular vote, I mean, the guy that came in second is now the president. That's weird. It's very weird. Not a way you run elections. Well, I came in second, but you've won the race. And then now, it would all hinge on Ohio. And John Conyers, the congressman from Detroit, has put out a book. It's called What Went Wrong in Ohio, the Conyers Report on the 2004 Presidential Election. And, woo, is this small print. The synopsis of it is both a riveting and alarming report on the status of our ailing presidential election process. This book provides new insights into the abuse and manipulation of electronic voting machines and the arbitrary and illegal behavior of a number of elected and election officials, which effectively disenfranchised tens of thousands of voters in order to change the outcome of an election. The material in this report should be used as a guidebook to fixing our federal elections. Well, no, they shouldn't be used as that. Well, yeah, I guess it could be. But really what it should be would be overturning the results of the 2004. But, you know, the Democrats are such a pack of wimps. I mean, they've had two elections in a row stolen from them. And the Conyers report is proof that the second one did. And they made less a stink about this one than they did the one before. I mean, maybe the Democrats are getting used to having elections stolen from them. Remember, Bush won the popular vote by 50.8. Yeah? And by their logic, if Bush had lost, let me see, if Bush had won the popular vote, I don't know how that would have gone. I can't figure it out. But that would have been a curious situation. There was fear that that was going to happen, that Gore would have won the electoral votes of Ohio and lost the popular vote, but won the electoral vote. Pardon me, the electoral college. Of course, then the Republicans would have said, "We got to get rid of the electoral college. It's terrible." All right. Hey, we'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hey, Tigers fans, this summer, why sit at home when you could sit at home? Fight, that is. Now is a great time to catch all the fun and excitement happening at every Detroit Tigers home game. You'll see plenty of homers by Pudge Rodriguez, Dimitri Young, Carlos Guillen, and all your favorite players. But a trip to Comerica Park means more than just baseball. While the Tigers are driving home runs, you could drive home in a brand new car during the Chevy Cobalt Drive One Home Giveaway, sponsored by your Detroit area Chevy dealers. Just buy a ticket to select Friday or Saturday night home games, and you could drive one out of here. Looking for a surefire hit? Hey, don't miss Friday and Saturday night fireworks, sponsored by Pepsi and Verizon Wireless. And with a weekend value pack, that's four tickets, four hot dogs, and four Pepsis for just $59. Hey, you'll want to bring everyone from home. So for great giveaways like autographed balls, bobbleheads, collector cards, and jerseys, and for great baseball, this summer, catch a Tigers game. For tickets, call 248-25-TIGER or visit DetroitTigers.com and make Comerica Park your home away from home game.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for big money. The OSI Pro Series WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Championship Series is underway, and there's still time to enter to win the $1,500 Series Championship. Sign up now for the Bass Championship going out of Lake Erie Metro Park on July 30th. Slots will fill up fast, so get your entry in now. Compete for thousands of dollars in cash and prizes, including the DMF Bait Award for the Kinnear 16 landing the largest fish on live bait. It's all going to be given away to the best fishing team in town, so sign up now by calling 248-591-6841 or go to WRIF.com for an entry form. There will be fun for everyone at the post-event party at Big Al Sports Grill, so call 248-591-6841 to become the OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Brought to you by OSI Pro Series, the DMF Bait Company, Big Al Sports Grill, and 101 WRIF.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-4255. 1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Walker's Speakeasy, the West Side's hottest destination for great food, drinks, and daily entertainment, located on Beach Daily in Dearborn Heights. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
This is WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. We'll do a little more on class matters, how income is distributed in this country, and the social and political and economic effects of it all. Anyways, that at 1 a.m., so we've got some more time for your calls at 313-298-WRIF. Thanks to Ben and Tom and others in Washtenaw County that wrote in, and yes, the email is working. Suddenly, I don't know, everybody started working it, too. Pam in Wyandotte wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I love your show. Thanks to my mom and dad for turning me on to it. One small request. How about a little plug for your listeners to sign Congressman John Conyers' letter to Bush requesting answers from the Downing Street Memo? Now, you can go to Downing Street Memo. Downing, like D-O-W-N-I-N-G, which is where Tony Blair lives, where the Prime Minister lives. And this gives conclusive proof about the lies of Bush around Iraq, that there weren't weapons of mass destruction, that they planned to go to war long, long before they even let on here with the United States. We all were played for suckers. Most of us fell for it, unfortunately. Lots of us didn't, though. And she says, Congressman Conyers wanted 100,000 signatures, and we have met that goal already. The next target is 250,000 signatures. The letter has been signed by approximately 100 members of Congress. And that means that 100 Congress people, and why do I suspect almost all Democrats, although there are some Republican exceptions. Let me see if I still have that. In any event, you can go to John Conyers, C-O-N-Y-E-R-S, johnconyers.com, and you can sign the petition there. It'd be a good thing to do, I think. Let's see. Oh, yeah, here. Pardon me. Boy, well, I'm even going to shut the mic for this one. You didn't want to hear that one. Remember the French fries thing? Then those... what were they called? Cheese-eating surrender monkeys. That was because France wanted to give the inspectors in Iraq another 30 days. And if they had, I mean, this is why Bush turned the propaganda machine on them, is because that he knew, and all of the warmongers in Washington knew, Cheney and Rumsfeld, all those guys, Powell, that if they waited a month like the French wanted, they couldn't invade. And they wanted to invade. They knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. They knew they were lying through their teeth. I mean, how stupid are they? I mean, they're evil, but they're not stupid. I mean, some of them are a little stupid. But, I mean, I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. A lot of you, I would say the majority of people that listen to this program regularly, either through listening to this show or bringing to this show the information that you could have easily found out that there were no weapons of mass destruction, right? So anyways, they had to lambaste the French. And so there was this goofy congressman, Walter Jones, a Republican congressman from North Carolina, that he famously led the campaign to change the name of French fries to Freedom Fries. Now he's against the war. Absolutely. He was also the brains behind the French toast becoming Freedom Toast in Capitol Hill restaurants, and he told a local newspaper that the U.S. now he says this, told a local newspaper the U.S. went to war, quote, with no justification. This is a Republican. Jones, who in March 2003 circulated a letter demanding that the three cafeterias in the House of Representatives office building ban the word French from menus, said it was meant as, quote, a light-hearted gesture. Now he's backing away from it. But the name change, all it's still in force. So if you go to the House of Representatives office restaurant, it's you can order Freedom Fries, okay? Let's see, it made headlines around the world, both for what it said about the U.S.-French relations and its pettiness. Actually, it made us look like a pack of fools. I mean, one of the negative perceptions that the rest of the world has about us, and, you know, you're saying, who cares what anybody in Saudi Arabia thinks? I'm talking about, like, Canada. I mean, they think we're a pack of wacks. Not W-A-A-X, like, but in, you know, wackos, like that. Jones now appears to agree. Asked by a reporter for the North Carolina News and Observer about the name change campaign, an idea Mr. Jones said at the time came to him by a combination of God's hand and a constituent's request, he replied, I wish it had never happened. Although Jones voted for the war, Republican Congressman Jones voted for the war, he has since become one of its most vociferous opponents at Capitol Hill, where the hallway outside his office is lined with photographs of the faces of the fallen. People that have died because of Bush's lies. Stephen in Dearborn Heights writes in, I was talking about how Secretary of War Rumsfeld is complaining about that China is upping its budget. Now, the United States spends $500 billion a year. I didn't know this. This is why I count on you folks so much. Stephen writes in, China had spent a paltry $50 billion on its military last year. So it's spending 10% of what the U.S. is. That's about what the U.S. will spend in Iraq over the next 10 months, and yet Rumsfeld is concerned about China's spending. Even if it was true that China has no enemies, a country just doesn't sit idle. Yeah, that's probably it. Okay, let's go back to our phones. Here is Gary waiting patiently. And Gary, what town are you in?
Marlette.
Marlette?
Yep.
Where's that? What state?
Up in the thumb, Michigan.
Oh, okay, good. All right, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I got a couple things for you guys. I know that you guys were kind of, you know, down-talking on the military a little bit there. As a soldier for the Marine Corps, I kind of think, you know, you guys are looking as you know, people are desecrating their religion. But wait, if you guys look at how we're treating them, look at how they treated our soldiers, beheading our soldiers, and nobody's caring about that.
What do you, wait, why would you think no one cared about it? I don't think they beheaded any of us.
No. See, you guys, they're throwing a big fit about these pictures, throwing a big fit about us desecrating their religion.
Yeah.
But look at what they do to us. There's not one of them that has been tried for any of them soldiers being killed over there.
Wait a minute.
Not one of them.
Wait a minute. No soldiers have been beheaded.
Look back into it.
Well, I don't have to look back into it. I mean, there were people beheaded, but they weren't soldiers.
There was an American soldier beheaded. There was proof of it.
Well, I mean,
there's been over 1,800 kills over there.
Well, wait. I know there was over 1,800 killed in the so-called coalition of the willing, but that's because the United States invaded another country which it had no right to do. I mean, if Bush would have told the American people the truth, there wouldn't have been any dead Americans.
Back up right there is what you just said, Bush. Okay, let's back up to Mr. Clinton here. Bill Clinton, prime example. You guys are dogging on Bush, but Clinton's the one who pulled us out. Clinton's the one who cut our military in half.
Right, you know, you are so filled with misinformation. You think that that Bill Clinton had cut the military budget in half?
I served during 1990.
Well, you may have, but there is no time that the United States military budget has ever been cut in half. I mean, you're making a wild exaggeration, my friend.
Cut in half. If you look into our budget cuts, our base closings, there is more than half our military cut.
Well, I mean, you said, when you say cut our military in half... and, you know, it was, by the way, it's Rumsfeld that was going to fight this war on the cheap and said we didn't need anybody and said we didn't need all this armor and that they were going to welcome us with welcome arms. I mean, the United States had no right under international law to invade Iraq. Everything that's happened over there, including the beheadings, let me back up a little. Nobody has the right to behave that beastly. But this was all set into motion by this illegal war that was generated by this pack of lies that Bush told people. Don't tell me about Clinton. I wasn't any big Clinton backer. Are you with me?
I didn't say you were. All I'm saying is you look back. Clinton pulled us out when Senior took us in. Senior took us in to do a job. As soon as Clinton took over office, he pulled us right out. He didn't let us finish our job.
Wait a minute. The person that didn't let us finish our job was a man named George Herbert Walker Bush that decided for a whole lot of reasons that he did not want to topple Saddam Hussein. They were, Rumsfeld went over there, gave Saddam Hussein a pair of golden spurs, gave Saddam all this intelligence for their war against Iran. American companies, German companies, all sold the bases of weapons of mass destruction to Saddam Hussein. Then when he was defeated and the American army could have certainly marched into Baghdad and overthrown Saddam Hussein, George Herbert Walker Bush decided not to do it. It wasn't, Clinton was the governor of Arkansas at that time.
We were in war when Clinton took over office.
We weren't in war. What are you talking about? There was no war going on then.
1990, the Gulf War.
Perfect. Yeah, I know. But Clinton took office on January 20th, 1993. 92. 93.
Trust me. Well, you consider the election year.
Well, but the person that decided to not, quote, finish the job was Bush Sr. Clinton was the governor of Arkansas at that time.
I totally disagree.
I mean, you think what do you disagree with? Those, you can't disagree about facts.
Clinton was involved.
Wait, how was Clinton involved? There was the United States and along with the United Nations invaded Iraq, chased Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. The war came to a quick conclusion, and rather than destroy the regime that Bush Sr. and Reagan had supported all through the 80s, they decided to allow Saddam Hussein to continue in office. George Clinton, I like George Clinton. Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas for the next 3 years. He didn't have anything to do with foreign policy. I mean, if you're judging, making political assessments and whether or not to risk lives here, you just got an enormous amount of misinformation. Okay, too much silence here, but think about it. Go read some history. A very important thing to do. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, can you turn your radio completely off, please? Because you're hearing that.
Wait, is this WRIF?
Yeah, and you're on the air, and you're hearing the 8-second delay, so you need to turn your radio completely off.
Oh, 8-second delay. Okay. I just got a few things I want to talk about.
What?
Oh, I said I have a few things I'd like to talk about.
First. Sure, go ahead.
Okay. You said about the illegal war against international law.
Yeah.
There is no international law.
You don't think there's any international law?
No.
Well, why is Slobodan Milosevic being tried in The Hague right now?
Oh, no, there's that kind of national law, but I mean...
Yeah, there's also United Nations law, I don't know what you call them, regulations, and there are things called crimes against peace, for instance.
Is it a crime against peace to gas hundreds of thousands of your own citizens?
Is it hundreds of thousands? Who gassed hundreds of thousands of their own citizens?
Saddam Hussein.
Well, he didn't gas hundreds of thousands. You got to remember that when he was doing this, he was being supported by the United States government.
He wasn't being supported in his gassing. He was being supporting his war against Iran.
Well, yeah, but the United States had the capacity to cut off Saddam Hussein at that point and saying that he was too reprehensible. So people like myself was critical of both of Saddam Hussein and of the United States government that was supporting him. But the Republicans, the conservatives, said, oh, well, you know, he's our ally. He was our boy, just like Saddam Hussein, just like Osama bin Laden was our boy. These are things that come back to bite us in the butt.
You know what came back to bite? In 1994, Bill Clinton could have gotten Osama bin Laden from Sudan after he had already bombed the World Trade Center with the little van bomb, and several times Sudan offered him, at least twice, I believe, to Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton said no, we didn't want him. We didn't have enough reason to take him, even though he already bombed the United States.
Well, that's some speculation. But let's say, okay, Bill Clinton is the worst person in the whole world and the worst president we've ever had. So moving on from that, what does that tell us about today? And the fact that the United States citizenry was fed a pack of lies by its government.
Okay. Well, I'll give him... There's another thing I want to talk about, but I can go back onto that later if you'd like, but because I really don't like talking about the pack of lies stuff because I just disagree with you, but Wait a minute.
Was it true or not that there were weapons of mass destruction? How did I know there were no weapons of mass destruction when the entire governmental structure was telling the American people that there were?
Probably because the entire governmental structure said that there were, and you just automatically didn't believe them because they were Republican, and you happened to be right in this case.
Well, I'll tell you, it's not a bad way to go, but forgetting about Republicans and Democrats, like my wife says, if they're on television and they're wearing suits, there's a good chance they're lying. In fact, a good assumption usually is when you see powerful people telling you very, very important things, that you would do a lot better to have enormous skepticism rather than immediately accepting what they say, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. I mean, Republicans have lied the most over the last, say, 20 or 25 years, but the Democrats, as you're getting it. I mean, aren't immune from making mistakes and telling BS.
Okay, I wouldn't say telling BS is just a mistake. Like, look at the Newsweek stories about flushing the crayon down the toilet. How is that even possible to flush a crayon down the toilet? It's just ridiculous.
Well, I thought the same thing, but that's like the Dan Rather thing. I mean, the overall... the idea that there's been this massive violation of human rights and desecration, if you've read today's paper or the yesterday's paper, this fundamental violation of human rights and what we consider to be simple legal rights of facing your accuser, being tried. I mean, we were holding people for years and years and years with no idea whether they ever had anything to do with crimes against America.
Well, a according to your precious international law, we have every right to do that. These are their enemy combatants.
Well, you know, when you say you're with that cynicism in your voice, John, what it strikes me is, just like any fascist, that ultimately it's the powerful that should be able to do what they want. That's a bad idea. Here's Sam and Ken. Sam, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Too bad you had to cut me out on the 8-second delay. That guy was pretty entertaining.
Oh.
I wanted to talk to you. I'm studying to be a teacher.
Good.
And I was wondering if you saw on the front page of the News/Free Press this morning about the first graduating class since 9/11.
You know, I saw the story, and I didn't read it, though.
It was pretty disturbing because it had a very positive tone to it,
uh-huh.
Saying how these students were more open to the world and willing to get involved. And then you read, and it had a very positive feel to it, but then you kept reading and they talked about the ones that want to join the military, which is, you know, a fine pursuit, except for if you don't have the ability to question the civilian authority that goes to it. And that's what a lot of these kids seem to be lacking.
Which
is just you know, the military's good, but it does answer to a civilian authority. And these kids were just, in a lot of ways, so blindly willing to go defend their country.
Well, I think it's fine to defend your country, but I don't think, I think what's going on now is defending Halliburton and defending, you know, the Exxon Mobil and what have you. But, you know, a lot of people will say that, but as you know, the recruitment rate is way down. And I'm just looking at this article. Let me see. When this was the third, which makes it, what, Friday, I guess. Growing problem for military recruiters, parents. And I was going to read a part of it. I just don't have any time to do it now. But it says that a Department of Defense survey last November, the latest, shows that only 25% of parents would recommend military service to their children, down from 42% in August of 2003. It says, one recruiter in Ohio said, parents are the biggest hurdle we face. So maybe I don't know. You know, who knows what kids are going to do?
Can I make one more point?
Sure.
You brought up the Enron and the Halliburton. This is just kind of my own personal complaint, but this entire religious right movement for the Republican Party, they're being so used because the judges they want on the bench are pro-business, not pro-life, per se.
You got it. Yeah, the other stuff is just a way to fool the rubes.
Yeah.
And the best way that they could stop abortions is to create a society in which nobody wanted to have one, but I don't think they're about that. All right, Sam, I got to take one more quick call before the end of the show, so thank you for yours.
Thank you, Peter.
Good luck on your studies.
Thank you.
Bye now. This is Ryan. Hey, Ryan, you're on the air. Go ahead.
How you doing, sir?
Good.
I have a couple things to say. I think your last caller, the last couple callers, actually checked in.
Ryan, you're completely breaking up. Yep. Sorry. Well, unfortunately, that does. I would have liked to have heard what he had to say. All right, it all continues. We're going to do a few spots, and then I have a couple of interesting interviews for you. So stay tuned for that, and we'll talk next week.
This is WRIF.com.
Motor City Harley Davidson Harley Fest 2005. Presented by 101, WRIF, Molson, and Jerome Duncan Ford. Your chance to nab a 2005 Harley Davidson Custom XL 883 Sportster.
Yeah!
Then, park it in the driveway next to a sweet new Ford Harley Davidson F-250 truck. And a glove box stuffed with $5,000 in gold, hard cash.
Compliments of Rock Financial.
Just keep your radio locked on 101, The Rift, to win a key. Along with tickets to see Tesla Friday, June 17th. Also, listen for details on Harley Bike Nights around the Motor City, where you can grab a key in person.
Yeah.
Harley Fest 2005, presented by Motor City Harley Davidson.
Feel the freedom at the number one dealer, located in Farmington Hills.
Molson,
making friends since 1786.
Jerome Duncan Ford,
Michigan's number one Ford dealer. Security provided by Gallagher Security. Trained professionals for crowd safety and management.
101 WRIF.
Riff Rock.
Bill Bonds with the commercial. If you're near or far-sighted and you want to throw away those glasses forever, I know a doctor you should see. Dr. Escombati. Phone number 1-877. Then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 1-877-UC-MORE. The equipment, the finest high-tech equipment ever made. Price $999 per eye. So don't fall for those $200 prices you hear being tossed around on the radio. Cows don't fly. Neither do those prices, unless your daddy is an eye doctor and you're getting a freebie. Dr. S. Kambadi, no doctor we know of has a better success rate. Procedure is fast, safe, cost $999 per eye. Virtually painless, you're in and out, maybe 40 minutes. Procedure itself, maybe 5. When it's over, you'll want to kiss your glasses goodbye and hug the doctor. Or maybe you guys will just want to give him a high five, shake hands with him, walk away, and see a whole new world. See ya.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
The Riff rocks the road. Every week, check out WRIF.com for information on upcoming Riff events. Sponsored by Wireless Toys, announcing no more activation fees. Get reimbursed for the activation fee on any new service, any new provider.
Riff rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. I'm going to say a word you don't hear much in public, so you may want to get the kids away from the radio. You know, and I don't want to offend anybody, but here it goes. Class. Not like a school class, but social class, economic class. We don't talk much about that. But I have an author with me on the phone from Boston who talks a lot about it. In fact, her book is called Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists. It's Betsy Leander Wright. And Betsy Leander Wright is an economic justice activist and the communications director for our friends at United for a Fair Economy. She's been on the show before. Betsy Leander Wright, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Well, Betsy, and people may know that I rarely call guests by their first name, but what do they want? A full disclosure, because the media is getting such a deservedly low opinions these days. Betsy Leander Wright and her partner, Gail, are friends of my wife and mine, and we've done, and Gail does provides this show with a lot of guests. So, there. I have
full disclosure.
Full disclosure.
Nepotism. I'm on through nepotism.
That's right. No, I would, but truth be told, I never would do that. I mean, I've had people that are friends that say, can you get this on? And I weasel out of it because it's not what I want to do. I do want to do this book.
That's right.
Class Matters. It's obviously double meaning.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I like the pun. I feel like it's a very popular pun now. Of course, Cornel West wrote a really great book called Race Matters, so I'm referring to him. And Bell Hooks wrote a really great memoir about her class experience as an African-American woman called Where We Stand, Class Matters. So my title gives a nod to both of them, and it does, it's saying the matters that I'm talking about are her class ones, and also if you had to sum up the message of the book in two words, it's, you know, when we try to make the world a better place or our communities better places to live, class matters.
Mm-hmm.
It matters to reach across to people who are different than ourselves in terms of their education or their income and draw on a bigger base and not get stuck in a class-segregated situation.
Well, historically, of course, that's been the case. I mean, there's always people seeking economic and social justice in movements across Europe and in North America. It's mostly been the working class, unionization, when you think about that, in terms of economic and social justice in that matter, and also always with allies in the middle class and sometimes even among the wealthy. But normally, when people think about economic issues and economic justice, it seems like the people that are lower down in the class structure have the most vested interest in equalizing things.
True, but I would say that every class level has had some movements for change come out of it. And just looking back historically, I did some reading when I was researching the book about the Votes for Women. Of course, this was a really important campaign to extend the suffrage to women that made a difference to women of all classes. It was mostly pretty privileged women who took the leadership in that, not entirely. And then at the same time, or overlapping periods of time, the labor movement, there was a whole lot of organizing of women workers, that had some middle-class allies, but as you were saying, came primarily out of working-class people. And one of the things I'm sort of positing is, what if the two had worked together more?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, they clashed. In fact, they got into a fight over the special protective legislation that had shorter work days and protections for breaks and so forth, how many pounds you could lift, the special protections for women. And the labor movement and the early first wave of the women's movement fought with each other over that. What if they had teamed up and said, well, let's try to get all our members of both movements to say, let's extend that legislation to everybody so that men and women can only work a 10-hour day. Wouldn't that have been more powerful? So, you know, it's easy with the hindsight of history to say what, oh, you folks should have done. But I think I can say that about movements all the way up to the present day.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that a lot of what I base my ideas, and I, from what I know of you, Betsy Leander, right, the same with you and most of the people at United for a Fair Economy, where you work as the communications director, have an ethical sense of fairness and justice. Yet, And that should go cross class, and it shouldn't. People that that apply the golden rule. I mean,
that's
it's
right.
It's as simple as that. Well, some people have said that it's the golden rule is he that has the gold rules, but that's not the one we mean, folks.
Other golden rule.
Yeah, the
that's
other
right.
golden rule.
That's right.
I was thinking, for instance, of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, that's celebrating the centenary
right.
of the 100-year founding of its. Of the union, and they in the preamble to their constitution it says the working class and the employing class have nothing in common, and they see it purely in terms of economic relationships, and they would say that your idea of cross-class alliances building for middle-class activists, I mean, it's okay if we can get middle-class people and wealthy people to support us, but ultimately it's going to be working people that are going to be the motive force of change.
Yeah, I'd say every time I put this message out, I get sort of very angry diatribes from old-school Marxists saying, yeah, that what we need is more class polarization and more conflict. And certainly we do need working class and poor people to have more organized collective expressions of their voice and their interests than we have now. We could use some equivalent of a labor party in this country. The Democrats are not performing that function. And I think that from in terms of social movements also, that's a thing that I think we should all wish for, that would bring some fairness to the bottom half of this economy. It would get us things that would be good for all of us, like universal health care, et cetera, would benefit middle-class folks, too. But I guess I do think it's naive to say, oh, that will inevitably be where the next big movement will come out of. And I guess the most recent movement that really, really inspired me and gave me hope that we can have change even in such a difficult political climate was the living wage movement, where in over 100 cities and towns across the country, people won an ordinance that the contractors, the businesses that did business with their city or their county, had to pay wages above the poverty level.
Mm-hmm. That includes Detroit as well.
That's right. Great. Yeah. And ACORN has pulled a lot of those together through the Living Wage Resource Center. But if you look at who initiated those campaigns and who put the muscle in, I think that you'll see it's a real class spectrum. Of course, it was the low-wage workers themselves involved, but often it was unions whose members were far above that level that they were fighting for, far above that minimum living wage, who just felt like no worker should be treated like that. You shouldn't work in full time and be in poverty. And we have a member in our Responsible Wealth Network. This is a membership group sponsored by United for a Fair Economy of wealthy people in the top 5% by income or by wealth. So you can shorthand them and say they're all millionaires or more. And one of our members recently wrote an article for the Responsible Wealth newsletter that you can see at responsiblewealth.org that says, I put in hundreds of thousands of dollars into the living wage fight in the Bay Area, and it was the best return on investment I ever got. He's a small business man himself, and because if you say how many people got raises because of the living wage ordinance there, and I think they got a city minimum wage, too, if I'm remembering right, that millions of dollars came back to people, to the working poor.
Sure.
From his donations. So I think those folks that send me the diatribes would just not expect that to happen, that this guy would see it as a really valid return on his investment. He has that business way of thinking. I'm going to put in an investment. I'm going to expect a return. Obviously, he's shaped by his business experience and framing it that way and not saying, I'm going to do philanthropy for social justice, which would not be his way of saying it. But he saw it as a return on his investment that thousands of minimum wage workers got a big raise.
I don't even know who it is, but I suspect he's trying to be kind of be kind of grumpy, because most of the people in responsible wealth, like who I've interviewed,
mm-hmm.
including Bill Gates Sr.,
mm-hmm.
are doing it out of an ethical sense that the world is not hung together very fairly.
Right.
Don't you think?
I do, and I think that we say in United for a Fair Economy that there are some self-interests that the bottom 95% of us have in shifting the rules so that it reduces economic inequality, that the way this economy is slipping, it's actually giving more economic insecurity to 95% of us. And then there's the enlightened self-interest of some within the top 5% that financially this economy may be great for them. They've gotten, you know, 4 tax cuts since President Bush came to office, and that benefits them financially. But in terms of the kind of world that they want to leave to their children and their grandchildren, they see some disturbing trends. They don't want to have to live barricaded inside gated communities. They want there to be public amenities and public safety. So, it is an ethical sense, but it's an ethical sense tied to a broader sense of self-interest than just your immediate number of dollars.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Betsy Leander Wright on the Peter Werbe Show. She's the author of the brand-new book, Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists. It's published by New Society Publishers, which has a great list of books in general. And I'll have a link to the book on my site as well, peterwerbe.com. Now, what you did in the book, in part, was to interview 40 activists, and but also I know that you're aware that among middle class people, working class people, even some poor people, you start talking about a fair economy or what is sometimes called redistribution of wealth in a fairer manner. And people just go ballistic. I mean, I get email whenever I talk about this on the air. You want to steal the money that these people have earned. And one guy wrote, "You want to steal the money of, quote, the rich that they've earned, and take their property." So, for one thing, it's hard for me to understand the anger of these people that are so far down the social ladder of the people whose interests they're defending. I don't know, the whole, I guess, galaxy of emotions there. Out of these interviews and the work you've done with United for a Fair Economy, do you get any sense of what's going on here?
I do. I feel like we've been looking a lot into the racial wealth divide in the last few years at United for a Fair Economy, and we have a website, racialwealthdivide.org, that sort of details how much more white people, even working class white people, have than the equivalent people of color in terms of assets, and what was the history of how that happened. And a lot of the people you're saying who have those attitudes, not entirely, but a lot of people who are being very angry about taxing the rich when they're not rich themselves, a lot of them are white, are European American, and there's a long tradition in this country of divide and conquer, of white working class people siding with wealthy white people rather than with working class people of color. You know, they're equivalents in income, but people who are different by race. And that's the image of, it's been real racialized in terms of who people imagine getting the breaks from the government. You know, in reality, that's not true. I think that we all lose out in terms of the public services we don't get anymore when the government gives huge tax cuts to wealthy people. The state budget cuts that we saw that were so devastating, a lot of us saw our libraries close or our parks or the schools get worse or get harder to get a child care subsidy.
Or in Detroit, where they're laying off firefighters and fire inspectors.
Oh, no, sir. That's terrible.
Yeah.
So those kind of cuts hurt people of all races. Of course, the lower income you are, the more you can't replace the lost government services from things from your own, you know, buying it yourself. But it, the picture that's been painted of who would benefit and who would lose if the rules were changed has been real racialized. So I think that's one part of the story. And I think we need to really say the rules need to be fairer for working class and middle class white people as well as for people of color. We need tax cuts that benefit people who are barely making ends meet, and we need to take back some of those tax cuts that went to people who already are raking it in with shovels.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I don't know the answer to this, so when I say to you that I'm not entirely satisfied with the answer, I hope that's not disparaging your answer. I mean, there's a level of
right.
anger about this that sort of mystifies me. I could imagine someone, if they said, well, I don't think this is going to work out, because then they, and sometimes you're going to take away their incentive, or, you know, there's some kind of some arguments of passion, approaching rational, but the level of anger to defend the wealth of people that don't even need defending it mystifies me.
It is incredible, and I think it's, you just, if you look at the history of the right-wing think tanks, of the messages that have come out of the Heritage Foundation, the Enterprise Institute, and so forth, there's been a concerted myth-making campaign that there is such a thing as, you know, the unfettered free market, and that it would be better for all of our self-interest. Of course, in any advanced industrial economy, bar none, decisions about setting the rules of the economy are made by the national government every day of every year. There is no such thing. I mean, I think they tried it in Russia briefly, and it basically meant the mafia took over, right, that, to try actually unregulated free market society. That it, you know, so regulation of the economy happens. The rules, you know, they have to make monetary decisions about what the interest rates are going to be every day. And the question, so people think that the question is regulation versus leaving it alone and letting the economy just happen. It's not true. Tax policy, who's going to get a tax loophole or tax break for what, monetary policy, trade policy, what are there going to be tariffs on, et cetera, what is the government going to spend its money on? These kind of decisions are made every day, and the question is, in whose interest? They're made in ways that are going to, and there's a giant fog in front of the of those decisions. We're, you know, we're being distracted. Like, don't look at that man behind the curtain. It's just kind of pretense that this isn't happening. And this is the mission of United for a Fair Economy, is to lift the fog, pull back the curtain on the Wizard of Oz or whatever, and say, you don't have to be an economist to understand this. You might need some advice from economists sometimes. I couldn't explain monetary policy to you, but I can ask smart people who can say that the monetary policy was set through the 90s with the goal of preventing wages from rising. Anytime wages started to rise, they hit the brakes on the economy to prevent that from happening. So, because they didn't want to cause inflation, they sort of decided that, you know, some people's interests were more important than other people's interests, and they did not worry about the people whose pay stagnated and didn't grow, and in some cases went backwards.
Yeah, well, I mean, they could put a brake on profit-taking as opposed to wage increases. But you're right. But there is then, what monetary policies do you put in place that'll create what effect? Betsy Leanderite, your book, Class Matters, and I said jokingly at the beginning of the show that I was going to say a word you rarely hear on radio, and that's class. A lot of people do find that offensive. It's almost tantamount to like a racial category. We're now race-free, we're class-free, and increasingly, oddly enough, in a period where the disparity of wealth is growing, people increasingly think anyone can make it.
Mm-hmm.
Where do these myths come from, and what's their function within the economy and the social structure?
Well, I think that one goes way back to the beginning of the founding of this country, and as an ideal, I think it's great. I think it's what we should be striving for. The line I loved best in the New York Times series, which is also called Class Matters, was when they said, the myth, I'm paraphrasing here, the myth that that we are automatically a land of opportunity leads to thinking we don't have to do anything to make that happen. We don't have to defend it. We don't have to build it. I think it's a great ideal, and that people are very, very attached to saying, no, it's true. And, of course, we do have some mobility. Obviously, you look around you, you do bump into people who are doing better than their parents, but a lot less than we think we have, less than we used to have, and a lot less than most other industrialized countries. So there's a confusion between, like, everybody knows somebody that it happened to. But you need to look across millions of people and say, what's the tendency? The tendency is for people to end up very close to where their parents started. Maybe whatever, if you divide the people up by fifths, we call them quintiles, one-fifth of the population by income, people tend to land in the same quintile as their parents, or one down or one up. Very few people go from one end to the other. And that's one of the startling things in both the Wall Street Journal and New York Times articles, is the evidence that's showing up to say fewer people are switching income brackets than a generation or two ago.
Well, so what we call formally like a limited class mobility, that not many people are going upwards from their class. Now, anecdotally, any number of people would say, hey, that's not true. You know, we read about immigrants that come here and they become millionaires, or all the, you know, kids start something like Google and they're billionaires. And mm-hmm. there's this evidence everywhere that people start off kind of poor or in lower middle class, and suddenly they're extraordinarily wealthy. Bill Gates, you know.
Bill Gates, in the 70s, went to a private high school that had a computer. Nobody had computers then. They almost hadn't been invented yet. There were no personal computers. But unlike anybody else, he got that computer experience in high school. He comes from a well-off family, as we know, because we work very closely with his father, Bill Gates Sr., worked very actively on behalf of Responsible Wealth in protecting the estate tax. Most of the people who made the Internet millions, you know, certainly there are things like that, or things like the post-World War II boom that lift up a whole bunch of people. But who got lifted up most were already pretty privileged people. There were very few people with working-class parents and who had a high school education who ended up as the new millionaires. So, yes, we do see a lot of new wealth. It mostly went to the people who were already pretty well off. And we also see people sinking. We see generations doing worse than their parents because, you know, the good manufacturing jobs, the unionized jobs have left the country, dried up. We're a service economy now. There's a lot higher percentage of the jobs in this country pay below what it costs to live now than was true a generation ago.
We should do this because we're rapidly running out of time with Betsy Leander, right, in her book, Class Matters. You can go to classmatters.org, by the way, and it'll be on my website, peterwerby.com. Let me say just quickly, though, it's also perceptual if, like, when I was 21 and I was selling shoes, I've advanced considerably in income. And But I'm at about the level my father was.
That's right. Okay. That's a really good way to explain it, that people feel a sense of upward mobility because most people during their lives go up. But the point is between families and between generations. Is your whole lifetime different?
Okay, we got to explain how we're going to fix all this in 2.5 minutes. There's people working on economic and social justice issues that you chronicle in your book, Class Matters. What's operational now, though, is a movement to conserve. They're conservatives to keep things as they currently are. What are the forces involved there, and what are our chances of changing things?
Well, I do see a lot of signs of hope, even though obviously there's not much call for economic justice coming out of the, you know, major branches of government at the federal level, for example. But I think that there's rarely been so much cross-class energy for economic justice in our history. Besides the living wage movement that I mentioned, there's the environmental justice movement that's teaming up of low-income people of color with middle-class environmentalists. There's the National Interfaith Committee on Worker Justice and also Jobs with Justice that are structuring ways for middle-class people and well-off people to plug into helping the working poor. There's United Students Against Sweatshops. That there's really been a great resurgence of people mobilizing for economic justice and explicitly providing chances for those of us who are more privileged to plug into those fights.
I noticed in the list of potential guests you sent out that the people go from the backgrounds of raised poor.
That's
to,
right.
Can I say this on the air? Is Chuck Collins, who we've interviewed so many times before. He's the great-grandson of
Oscar Meyer
Wiener.
That's right. Yeah, we deliberately, this is a group called Class Action.
Yeah.
Theirs is classism.org is their website. And they deliberately have people from these multimillion dollar heirs down to people who've, you know, lived for most of their lives on welfare or working sub minimum wage jobs. So doing some cross-class dialogue, like actually talking to each other about what has your life been like and learning from each other and saying, well, what gifts does your experience give you and how can we better work together? It's a brand new group and it's very exciting. I'm on the board of it.
Well, Betsy Leonderite, you have more websites than I don't know what. So what I'm going to ask you to do, because I can't even, I don't have them all in my head, is send me an email. I'll get them all on my website as well. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Always so nice to talk with you, Peter.
The book is Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists, published by New Society Publishers. I'll have it all on my website. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
WRIF.com. Bill Bonds with a commercial. If you're near or farsighted and you want to throw away those glasses forever, I know a doctor you should see. Dr. Escombati. Phone number 1-877. Then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 1-877. You see more. The equipment, the finest high-tech equipment ever made. Price $999 per eye. So don't fall for those two.
To be with you, there's a lot in the news about gay marriages. In fact, here in Michigan, some of these right-wing fundamentalists are trying to force onto the ballot something that would prohibit gay marriage. And yet, as we've found out, either through our friends, our family, or television, there are a lot of gay people, gay men in couples, gay women in couples. Once in a while, the idea of families come in as well. There's a book that I'm holding in my hands right now that addresses the subject of lesbian mothers, their children, and the undoing of gender. This is the subtitle of the book, The Family of Man. Excuse me, that's what it's taken from. It's The Family of Woman. Maureen Sullivan is my guest. She's properly laughing at me. And she's a visiting assistant professor of social studies at Harvard University. Maureen Sullivan, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you, Peter.
Any idea how many lesbian families with children there are? I mean, are we talking about a phenomena of some substance?
It's some substance, though demographers and statisticians would probably yawn. It's anywhere from, well, some of the quotes, and again, it's a very difficult population to identify for all the reasons that we know. It's very difficult to identify and properly count populations that for one reason or another, you know, are kind of stay in a secret place in society, are not fully visible. But some of the numbers that have been thrown out is anywhere from 3 million to 8 million children have gay and lesbian, gay or lesbian parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, and those numbers include children whose parents, you know, were first originally in heterosexual partnerships and marriages, and then they came out later, and so these numbers really aren't very helpful for understanding how many gay and lesbian couples are actually couples who intentionally planned and incorporated children into their lives as couples and as planned families. So the numbers, in a way, don't really mean all that much, I guess, is probably my response to that.
So there is a significant number of people involved. Now, when we talk about men, obviously those are all adopted. But in your book, The Family of Woman, you interviewed 34 families headed by lesbian mothers, and these were children that were conceived by means of donor insemination. So these are women who had children by natural birth. And a connection that you know, we usually think of, as much as people love adopted children, this is direct biological children. Is that unusual, or is that the norm within lesbian families?
That is becoming fairly normal insofar as sort of donor insemination has become medically and legally protected and secured, so that no third parties can come in and lay any kinship claims or parental claims to children resulting from the insemination and the various reproductive assistance that lesbians will use to conceive children. It was much more the practice, I would say, in, say, perhaps the late 70s and early 80s to adopt children. And I'm not saying that has necessarily waned. Many, many lesbian couples choose to adopt children rather than have biologically related children. But as many of the mothers in my book talked with me about, because I asked them this very question, why did you not adopt? Why did you want to have biologically related children? And many of them said that it was easier to get pregnant, that it was less expensive, that it was, you know, much more sort of quickly done, and a lot of those things. And then some of their answers had to do with wanting biologically related children.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are many different factors that are sort of moving people in the direction of having biologically related children. But I do think that because of some of these protections that are in place now and the relative facility with being able to do this through a infertility clinic, or I should say more of a sperm bank or insemination clinic, because that's really sort of where people are going. They don't go into the more high-tech route of infertility treatment and so forth unless they run into problems. So I think it really is partly that.
Well, my wife and I know a couple, two women who have a child, and it actually, until I looked at your book, The Family of Woman, it never occurred to me to ask them. I don't think I will, now I'm thinking, why did they decide one other rather than the other would have the child? One is older, and that could have been a factor. But in a lesbian couple, is there any pattern to the decision making as to who will be the mother?
Yes. Actually, I probably need to correct you on that one, biological mother or birth mother, because they're both mothers.
Yeah, you're right.
So who they decide will be the birth mother is probably the correct way to say it.
Wait, why is that? Actually, I said, yeah, that's right, but why are they both mothers? Because they're both women?
Because they are both choosing to identify themselves as mothers as something else.
Yeah, that's right. What would you ascribe to them in terms of a conventional title? There isn't one. So, okay, one's the biological birth mother. Right. How's that decision often made in these couples you interviewed?
Yeah, the decision is made just as you suggested. First, or one consideration is who is older and whose, you know, quote unquote biological clock is sort of ticking and about to run out as they see it. And so, if they both want to be birth mothers, they will have the older one try to get pregnant first. If it is an intention to also stagger the pregnancies and have different children of different ages. Another factor that played into it was in cases where both women wanted to be birth mothers at some point, but one decided to go first, it was often the case that the partner who didn't want to go first wasn't ready in terms of her own sort of psychological and emotional preparedness or in terms of her work and her career situation. And that seemed to be one of the biggest factors. The other consideration was just the situation where one partner just simply didn't want to be a birth mother at all,
mm-hmm.
ever. And so that was pretty clear-cut who the birth mother would be in that situation. So those are really sort of the three scenarios that I heard most often.
Maureen Sullivan is my guest. She's a professor, assistant visiting professor of social studies at Harvard University. Her book is The Family of Woman. It's published by the University of California Press. And Maureen Sullivan, we are talking about this like it's just everyday and usual. And on the other hand, we know that there's a lot of people on the Christian right who just have their shorts in a major uproar about this. And they think it's going to erode the traditional family, it's going to hurt marriage, it's going to hurt society, except they never really say how. I mean, I've been married quite a while, and I guess I don't feel that in any way either gay marriages or lesbians having children is doing anything to my relationship. How do lesbian mothers perceive of themselves in all of this? I mean, they're being told that they're these awful people, that they're what is their self-perception and also how they feel about how people on the Christian right perceive them?
Well, one way to answer that is Well, first, maybe not to say what I think, how I think the lesbian mothers themselves would address that, because you know, they spoke to that issue a little bit when I interviewed them. But what I would say to that, in a more general sense, is that the Christian right or the religious right, the far right, often want to, you know, lay out this argument, which they don't actually support very well with much evidence, but they lay out the argument that indeed alternative families, lesbian mother families, gay father families, single parent families, and so on, are somehow going to undermine the traditional heterosexual nuclear family, what they think of as the traditional nuclear heterosexual family. Well, first of all, we have to understand that that is an ideal type. It's an ideology. It's an ideological type, if you will. And what that means is it's something that is very abstract, and it's something that is not in sense empirically true. If you look at the wide spectrum of family types in the United States and in Europe, the levels of cohabitation, unmarried cohabitation, unmarried childbearing, all of these different kinds of ways of having intimate relations with and without children, you understand that the lived reality on the ground is not that there is this one monolithic traditional heterosexual parent nuclear family. So that said, if you are someone who believes this and who believes that this is something that comes from God, and thinks that this is the absolute right way to do something, and it is ordained both by God and nature, then it makes sense that the biggest bugaboo there can be is someone coming forth, showing viability and becoming visible as an alternative to that model. And so I think in some ways the imagined threat on the part of those on the far right and the religious right is in a sense real to them, because the ideal that they have in their mind is real to them, even if it is not real on the ground, as mm-hmm. it were. Now, how do lesbian families address this? How do they deal with that you know, sense of them as threatening to the status quo? Many of them actually still feel that it is they who, in a sense, are threatened by sort of mainstream heterosexual culture.
Sure.
And that's true with Matthew Shepard and with sort of the battering that people are taking, just trying to hold their families together against the threats of legislation banning same-sex marriage. I mean, so the way they are trying to do everything they can to protect their families from heterosexual culture, legal, medical, social, popular culture, certainly. I mean, so there's all these ways in which, because they are still an oppressed group, a group that is denied basic civil rights and liberties, you know, they have to go a long way towards sort of combating what is a real threat to their welfare and well-being.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was just going to say that, and this sort of sounds flippant, but when I've done phone-in talk shows and somebody will come up and say, oh, they're going to ruin marriage and all that, I get back from the mic and yell at the top of my lungs, get over it. And to some extent, we hopefully are moving towards a society where people just butt out of other people's business. William Burroughs, the Beat author, said that these people are busybodies, people that have no business of their own, or worse, aren't taking care of their own business, then butt into and insert themselves into the lives of others. But Maureen Sullivan, let me address something that's in the subtitle of your book, The Family of Woman, Lesbian Mothers, Their Children. We've been talking about these families, but then this sort of sleeper at the end, the undoing of gender. So to an extent, or maybe directly, the threat perceived by the Christian right to authoritarian patriarchy is in fact real. So these people are defending a power relationship that means a lot to them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you're absolutely right also, Peter, to pick up on the idea that I'm using gender in the subtitle as just another synonym for authoritarian patriarchy or heteropatriarchy or you know, there's all kinds of words that academics bandy about to describe this. But it's basically the system that we live in where, you know, it's heterosexual male control over women and sort of subordinate types of men, working class men, men of color. You know, so all these social hierarchies that we understand having to do with gender relations. But particularly the main hierarchy, the main relationship of domination and subordination being between men and women. And traditional, so-called traditional heterosexual marriage is very much a linchpin of that system. And so that's absolutely right that same-sex marriage does stand to challenge that at a kind of level that it is abstract, it's conceptual, but at the same time, I think it can have and will have practical effects. I don't think they'll be immediate, and I don't think that the right will sort of roll over and let it happen. But I do think that their perception of the threat is correct. Although I think much of it might be sort of unconscious.
Well, yes, and it's a threat to them. I mean, one of the things I've always been taught in Tai Chi Chuan is if you present a rigid target, you can be pushed over easily.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the key. I mean, flexible authoritarians hate flexibility, right? They don't like that. Maureen Sullivan is my guest. Her book, The Family of Woman, Lesbian Mothers, Their Children, and the Undoing of Gender. You're listening to The Peter Werby Show. Well, let's talk about some of the practical aspects. One of them, well, I don't, maybe this isn't practical, but it has to do with families themselves. When oftentimes when people are describing poverty families where that in households headed by women, there's often talk that one of the problems is that there's not a male, father figure or role model. That's it. So here you're not going to have any male role model. And there may be, I don't know, I mean, most of the gay women I know aren't anti-man, but, you know, some of them aren't that appreciative of my gender. So what about this idea of male role models not being what has been in the traditional families throughout the ages?
Mm-hmm. Here's a question that I can actually sort of channel the mothers to speak directly to, the mothers from my book. They did see having two mother families and no paternal figure, no paternal authority figure as a very good thing. And many of them were talking from their own direct experience of their own families of origin or from those they had seen in their lives growing up where there were, you know, particularly controlling or abusive fathers, sometimes even violent, or sometimes just neglectful. And so a lot of what they see as a good and positive thing is to have two very strong, fully engaged, fully involved parents without that, you know, just the risk of having a kind of volatile paternal figure who may or may not do harm at some time in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so that being said, much of, you know, there's much talk both in the social science literature and sort of just in public discourse about it can't be a good thing to be creating families without fathers. And my response to that is that is, in a sense, giving privilege to a structure of family, a type of family that is composed of certain sort of gendered, you know, people in gendered positions in our society, rather than speaking to the issue of who these people are and what kind of parents they are. And so what I would suggest is that what you really need in families is people who are fully realized human beings who can be the best kind of parents possible, and that, you know, the gender of the parents is absolutely not the point. If the two parents or three or four, however many are involved, or one, you know, are fully realized human beings capable who are themselves supported if they are caregivers or primary caregivers, you know, if they are not themselves in great need. And so that's my response. But usually in sort of the public discourse, we hear a lot about, oh, just these kids are going to be juvenile delinquents. They're going to be, you know, into drugs and into street gangs and all of this other stuff if there are no fathers around. Mm-hmm. And I just can't. I know. I mean, that's a very popular argument that you know, a lot of studies, you know, try to support in various ways, and I've seen those studies. But I just am not convinced that there have been enough studies done where there are fully competent, well-supported, economically secure parents of all kinds of genders and numbers of parents to show the opposite case.
Have we had enough experience with gay families to know how the kids turn out? Because I remember on a talk show someone said, well, you're going to have gay parents, you're going to have gay kids. And I said, and I didn't know one way or the other. So I said, well, what business is it of yours, you know? But that doesn't answer the question. I mean, it's not. Again, it's, you know, butt out. I mean, it's not your family. It's not, you know, it's none of your business. But and also posing the question like that says that being gay is negative, which... Mm-hmm. I hope most of us have moved beyond. But has there been any look at the way the kids of the gay parents, men, or in the case of the women, the lesbian mothers you've studied?
In terms of sexual orientation or sexuality, you're right to note that, you know, in many circles, people would regard that that the question itself is kind of homophobic, as suggesting that there's something wrong with being gay.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question of, well, will the kids turn out gay, that would automatically suggest that there's something wrong with being gay. To set that aside for the moment, because this question is actually one that is very hot in terms of how the same-sex marriage debates are going, because the same-sex marriage debates turn on the question of whether or not gay couples are, shall we say, sufficiently procreative compared to their heterosexual counterparts, which obviously my book and many other, you know, stories are showing that gay parents are perfectly procreative, gay couples are. But the other element is, can gay parents be fit parents? And so then the question of sexual orientation always creeps in.
Sure.
And that's the homophobic part of the interrogation, and also the homophobic part of this injection of this question into the same-sex marriage debate from the right. So I just wanted to really contextualize that a bit. But the studies are very inconclusive of those children who have been raised in, you know, so-called intact gay parent households. And a lot of it is that it's very unclear how to even understand or approach, you know, measuring what it is to grow up in an intact gay or lesbian parent household. Gay and lesbian parents are no more likely to stay married or stay together than their heterosexual counterparts. And so it is very difficult to really even measure what it actually means, what the influence of parents' sexuality would be on kids. Now that said, I keep throwing out all these caveats, disclaimers, but
I'm listening. This is all very interesting. Go ahead.
But there's some speculation that it makes absolutely perfect sense that in an environment where parents are openly communicating about all the issues that come up for themselves and their children. You know, children ask, where did I come from? Who's my daddy? So on and so forth. In an environment where parents are committed to very clear communication and open communication with their children, which is one thing I found with my mothers and the families that I interviewed, you're naturally going to have a greater openness toward questions of sexuality. And I think, and so the theory or the speculative theory that follows this argument goes, because these are going to be more open and there's going to be less stigma around sexuality in general, kids are probably going to feel freer to explore all kinds of sexual, you know, interests.
Mm-hmm. So really, the evidence isn't all in, and as like I said, probably isn't any of our business. You know, one of the key questions, and we've got about 30 seconds, what happens when the question is asked, they say on the billboard, who's your daddy? Is that ever a problem? And we really only have about 30 seconds to answer. That's horrible to say.
No, that's okay. The way that mothers respond to that question is in age-appropriate ways. So if their child is able to understand the concept of fertilization and conception and meeting of sperm and egg, then they will say that, you know, your daddy is a nice man who offered to help make you
mm-hmm.
and, you know, donated this fluid or part of himself to do this. But it all depends on how they want to define the relationship with the donor or the father. Sometimes they want the men who donated the sperm to have an actual relationship with their children. So those are all open to negotiation and definition.
Maureen Sullivan, thanks so much for joining me. The book is The Family of Woman, Lesbian Mothers, Their Children, and the Undoing of Gender. A lot more questions we haven't answered as well. They're in the book. Pick it up at go to an independent bookstore first, then check the chains. Maureen Sullivan, thanks for joining me on The Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter.
This is WRIF.com. Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Motor City Harley Davidson Harley Fest 2005. Presented by 101 WRIF, Molson, and Jerome Duncan Ford. Your chance to nab a 2005 Harley Davidson Custom XL 883 Sportster.
Yeah.
Then, park it in the driveway next to a sweet new Ford Harley Davidson F250 truck. And a glove box stuffed with $5,000 in sold hard cash.
Compliments of Rock Financial.
Just keep your radio locked on 101 The Riff to win a key, along with tickets to see Tesla Friday, June 17th. Also, listen for details on Harley Bike Nights around the Motor City, where you can grab a key in person.
Yeah.
Harley Fest 2005, presented by Motor City Harley Davidson.
Feel the freedom at the number one dealer, located in Farmington Hills.
Molson,
making friends since 1786.
Jerome Duncan Ford,
Michigan's number one Ford dealer.
Security provided by Gallagher Security. Trained professionals for crowd safety and management.
101 WRIF.
Riff Rock.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants. Like Clubhouse Tavern, located in the fabulous Fisher Building, offering great food at great prices. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Dave Durant. It's 101 WRIF Detroit, and we are Pearl Jamming on the Rip.